This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, Schlemiel, Schlemazel, Hassan Beff Incorporated.
We're going to do it.
Give us any chance, we'll take it. With any rule, we'll break it.
Place to Be Nation, welcome to a very special podcast here on the Place to Be Nation Pop Feed. That's right, we're going to be here memorializing, looking back, doing a little positive talk about some people that passed away. This is our In Memoriam 2018 show, as we look back at some of the famous people, celebrities, and the like that passed away this past year. And joining me to talk some positives here about all these lovely people are a great group of guys. So let me start off first with the, he's the co-host of the Place to Be podcast, the co-host of Main Event, and my co-host on the Year in Pop, Mr. Scott Criscolo. Scott, thank you for joining me tonight.
Good evening, Mr. Atherton. My Monday time is very premium, so I will be giving a bill to the Pop Feed administrator. Wait, that's Brad. I pay him. Never mind. Anyway, it's great to be here. I did a In Memoriam podcast a couple years ago, actually. That one was strictly music, and that was that really tough year. I guess it was, 2 years ago when Prince died and David Bowie and Glenn Frey. I think that was 2 years ago, 2016.
Yeah.
I think it was. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that was the last time. So I'm familiar with eulogizing, which is, for the most part, what we'll probably be doing this evening. But it's good to be here. Yeah. Looking forward to it.
Cool. Thank you. Also joining us, he also is on the Main Event. He's the third man in the booth, and he often appears on the Glenn Butler podcast Spectacular to find the good in everybody. He is the conscience of Place to Be Nation, Mr. Steve Willey. Steve, thank you for joining me tonight.
Hey, it's nice to be on with you, Andy. Thank you. I'm excited to hang out with you guys for an evening and talk about dead people.
Do you see dead people, Steve?
Just in my sleep.
Dead podcast careers.
Yeah, another topic for another show. Right. And rounding out our quartet tonight, he is the co-host of Survey Says over on the Place to Be Nation Wrestling Feed. And here on the Pop Feed, he is the co-host of Talkin' Pop and one of the Sarcastic Four in the Marvel Age podcast with Mr. Todd Weber, Nick Duke, and Mr. Russell
Sellers.
Sellers, sorry. I took a breath in mid-sentence. Apologies to Russ. Mr. Tim Cable. Tim, thank you for joining.
Andy, thank you for the and credit. You know, I very much appreciate that, and I am looking forward to bringing the room down, which I am well qualified to do. So, great to be here. Thank you for having me on another one of your programs here in recent memory, and I'm happy to be here with Scott and Steve.
Yes, this is. Thank you, Tim, for joining me. What basically we want to do is we're going to look back, and we're going to. This is a positive show, a remembrance show, if you will. These people,
that's
you know,
what you think.
Well, that's what I hope.
There's a back door somewhere.
Yeah, but. So we're just going to go around the room, talk. We're going to mention these names, and everybody's going to say kind of like, you know, some of their favorite work or the influence or kind of the effect they may have had on them. You know, it goes in hand like with, like, you know, award shows. This is the award show season, and everybody, for whatever reason, loves the In Memoriam thing, and it kind of gets you all. So, you know, we're trying not to be sad. We're trying to be happy and celebrate these lives and thank them for what they gave us. So let's start off with one of the more recent passings back in December on the 17th. At the age 75, we lost the great Penny Marshall. Scott, why don't you talk about Penny?
Well, Penny Marshall, I mean, anybody who watched TV in the last 40 years, even if you were a kid in the 70s or even in the 80s, She'll always be known as the girl with the L on her chest, or on her clothes, I should say. She was Laverne, Laverne. She was always Laverne, as it was on Happy Days. She's a local girl. She grew up in the Bronx. So not bad. On the Grand Concourse, Mr. Atherton.
That's the Grand Concourse. Right up from Yankee Stadium.
That's right. And, of course, her dad was Gary Marshall, who was a legendary TV producer who done a lot of tremendous shows. I mean, to me, she'll always be Laverne. She was Laverne going back to the episode of Happy Days when she was I think, the Fonz's date in an episode. Let me double check that. Oh, she was on The Odd Couple. That was actually her first TV appearance. She worked in Oscar Madison's office on the old Odd Couple. In fact, I watched a couple of Odd Couple episodes New Year's Day. That's kicking it old school up here in the Northeast. New Year's Eve, New Year's Day, you either watch The Odd Couple or The Honeymooners. It was usually on the New York channel, New York tri-state area channels throughout the last, 45, 50 years. And, she was one of the most recognizable people on TV at the time. And did I say father? I meant brother. My bad. I feel bad for Gary Marshall. He's dead too, right? Didn't Gary Marshall pass away too?
Yes, he passed away the year before.
Okay. Well, I feel bad that I made him so old. he was actually Penny's brother. I meant brother, not father. My bad. She was living in the basement in Milwaukee with Shirley Feeney, working for Schatz's Brewery. And Laverne and Shirley was just one of those great shows that I used to watch back in the day. It was always on after Happy Days because they went hand in hand back in the days of spinoffs. And then obviously she's more known more recently for her directing. And I'm trying to think some of the movies. Let's see what she directed. She directed Big. That was probably your first real big, no pun intended. she directed Big. She directed Awakenings. I forgot about that. Awakenings is the movie with Robin Williams and Robert De Niro.
I actually love that movie.
It's an exceptional movie. If you've never, Steve, that's a movie you would like. I don't know if you've ever seen it.
Yeah, I've seen part of that one.
Yeah, that's a great movie. Robin Williams plays a doctor. I don't know if he's a psychologist, and Robert De Niro is this guy who was in a coma for like 25 years, and then suddenly he wakes up and he's not sure like of his surroundings. It's an exceptional movie. That was hers. And of course, the one that I know her best in is A League of Their Own, which is probably a top five baseball movie for me. It's not number one. Number one to me would always be The Natural. But mm-hmm. League of Their Own is a good movie.
Featuring her brother as Walter Harvey, the yes. owner of the league, I guess, or the Peaches, I guess.
Yes, the Rockford Peaches.
Mm-hmm.
And a great ensemble cast, and of course had Tim. Tim would have been great in it. But obviously Tom Hanks before he stopped realizing that comedy movies aren't cool, apparently. She's been in great movies. She was in 1941, great movie with Jump.
I love that movie, Scott, but not a lot of people would call that a great movie.
Well, it's great in its own special way. She was in Get Shorty as herself. Let's see what else she was in. Oh, she was in High Fidelity? I didn't know that. Oh, she was at a funeral. She was uncredited in a funeral. I didn't know that. Most recently, she was in Scooby-Doo and Kiss, Rock and Roll Mystery. Don't they sell that on WWEshop.com? So anyway, but she's probably most known for directing Big, A League of Their Own, and of course, Laverne on Laverne and Shirley. But she'll be missed. She was a very important part of pop culture and television for the last, 40 years, just like her brother. So she'll be missed.
Yeah, one of the early female directors to, get some...
Make it big,
yeah, yeah. Her, Penelope Spheeris, those were sort of the trailblazers of what we have today. Steve, Tim, you guys, any Penny Marshall memories, thoughts you want to air?
Well, I remember from the Laverne and Shirley reruns growing up, and I only lived on a first floor and a third floor in Milwaukee, so I can't really identify with living in a basement in Milwaukee. and of course, Big is one of my favorite movies as a kid, and I actually just saw it in a barcade literally last weekend. So it's just an old favorite.
Nice.
It's, And I forgot that she directed that. I knew she directed League of Their Own and Awakenings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to say, I don't know that I had any idea she was a director, but a pretty decent pedigree to her name with A League of Their Own. Not that I'm a huge sports movie guy, but that's a great comedy. Big as well. Jumpin' Jack Flash, how about that?
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Whoopee.
That was her first one.
Right. So, and as far as her television work, I mean, Laverne and Shirley went off the air the year I was born. And for whatever reason, I never really got well acquainted with it in reruns or anything. So, I mean, not someone I've had a ton of exposure to, but, I mean, her body of work is so enormous that I've probably seen her in a lot of stuff just without even realizing it.
Yeah, I mean, when they were, before Laverne and Shirley, they were on Happy Days as a couple of dates for Richie and Fonzie. And Laverne was actually the Fonz's date. And then Richie goes on to have this, like, horrible date with Cindy where I think they're walked in on by the rest of the family. So it was quite a funny episode.
Which is ironic considering they were the couple in American Graffiti.
Yes.
George Lucas's first movie. So that's pretty funny that they were in that and then they were a shit show on that episode of Happy Days. So pretty funny.
All right. Well, rest in peace, Penny. So so back on June 8th, at the age of 61, we lost Anthony Bourdain. Now, he was a big lifestyle food host. But Steve, why don't we talk about Anthony Bourdain?
Yeah, definitely. I've talked to a few people over the last couple of years, and whenever celebrity deaths hit, they don't really affect me that much anymore. I don't know why that is, if I'm just a grizzled old man at this point, or I just, like, after, like, someone has a really long life, like someone like Penny Marshall, who lived a very long, very successful life, you know, she passed away, and that's sad, but it's part of life, but for some reason, Anthony Bourdain actually did affect me, and I was surprised to see how many other people in my circle it affected. My sister is a chef, and a pastry chef, and her husband is a chef, so I like knew that they would have some sort of connection because his initial work that he became famous for was his book Kitchen Confidential. It really told behind the scenes what really happens in restaurants amongst chefs, and it studied very much, and it made people kind of feel like someone got them. I knew Anthony Bourdain, well, not personally, of course, but more from his travel shows, like No Reservations, which was on the Travel Channel, and Parts Unknown. And I really enjoy, I don't really like those type of shows, but this one drew me in just because he went to so many different places. And it wasn't just, we're going to explore your food. You're going to expose the viewer to like history and the sociology of the places. And so you just kind of start with the food and really understand the greater culture of the country. And when he sits down with people, it could be natives that literally don't even speak any, you know, just native language. It could be, you know, historians, it could be celebrities, it could be big time chefs. And all these people start opening up to him and you really get a glimpse as to what the world is really like in these countries. And it was very artistic. A lot of times they would get like a cinematic theme. And it just, like, for me, gave me not just a look into other countries, but like really affirmed my desire to travel the world and kind of understand a little bit more of what's going on. And it reminds you how small we really are. The sad part about Anthony is, like, in his youth, especially, he was kind of a hippie, like an anti-war guy, you know, into drugs, the drug culture from, especially like in the restaurant scene at that time. Had a couple of failed marriages, and part of that was due to the travel in his later years. But he had been clean for many, many years. And he committed suicide on June 8th, and it was very shocking. Like, no one in his circle thought that could ever happen. And there's still a lot of questions as why, because even the last couple of weeks of his life, everyone said he was fine. So I don't know if we'll ever understand really what happened there. To me, he's known for bringing people together, having a really sharp wit, and someone who can bring people together, not just within a country that he's visiting, but to the viewers. You can really bring people together in what's really a time of division in our country.
Yeah, it's totally suicide. Totally is tragic and so misunderstood with mental illness. And sometimes, you know, like Robin Williams, you know, we didn't, you know, we knew Robin had a ton of issues in his life, but you know, we never knew that that would happen with him. You know, and I get what you're talking about too, about the travel and food shows, because I'm a huge Andrew Zimmern fan myself. Actually, he's like kind of like the I guess the vanilla version of Anthony Bourdain, I would say. You know, but I love those shows. It gets to show you, like, I people probably know I work in television, and they would ask me, like, you know, what would you want to do if you could pick? And I said I would want to be on Bizarre Foods, on the crew, because you get to travel the world, you get to try all these, get to meet all these interesting people and see all these things. So I see, you know, that part of it, and Anthony Bourdain just, you know, he spoke his mind, you know, and he had a sense of humor, which I don't know how, maybe it was like last year or the year before, he was on Jimmy Fallon, and Jimmy's done this at least twice. You can look it up on YouTube, where they do this thing with ingredients. They kind of like mess with you, and they show you these things, and one of the things was it looked like an orange creamsicle, but it was actually made out of Velveeta. So they had this like game where they got to write down what they thought it was, and of course gets the most points. So I suggest you pick it up because he is really, really funny in this. Tim, Scott, you guys got anything to add about Anthony Bourdain?
Yeah, I'll just say that like Steve, I'm not a huge fan of these sort of travel or shows just as a general rule, but he was no doubt a pioneer in that somewhat strange cottage industry, right?
Yeah.
Where it's, is it a travel show? Is it a food show? It's a little bit of both. And also was a gateway for me to Andrew Zimmern, who I thought of as well. And it was really the two of them that if I was going to watch something like that, that's about as far as I could push it. But something like No Reservations that you mentioned, I mean, if there's nothing on and I'm flipping channels and I see that, an easy watch, I'm just going to throw it on and kind of, I don't want to say check my brain, but it's something that you can put on in the background while you're doing other things. Every now and then something will really catch your eye. And yeah, I mean, I could watch stuff like that when I didn't have a whole lot of other options. And especially like when I was in school and working and going to class and having sort of strange hours. And these were the kinds of shows that would be on, you know, in reruns, of course, that I'd find myself sitting in front of for no real reason, but it's sort of the memories I have of that.
That's really what's great about it, because you can do it that way, or you can sit and really, really closely pay attention and do a deep dive into it.
Yeah,
you can do either way, and that's brilliant. Not many shows can do that.
Can be very immersive or very casual at the same time, depending on what you want your experience to be. One of those figures who absolutely a rock star within his field and had an ego about him, but would just sort of lay all that aside and not come into these very unusual locales with any pretensions, and would just, you know, take it for what it was and be a great presenter of this very slice of life show that's, as you said, Steve, not just about the food, but about the culture as well. I mean, I guess that feels sort of voyeuristic, but not really in a bad way. And yeah, I mean, as far as the circumstances of his death, I guess we make the mistake, especially when it comes to public figures, of not of feeling like we know their private lives just based on their public personas. And, you know, people have rich interior lives and we really don't know them and can't assume that we do just based on the fact that they're a personality on television. Seems like we have to keep relearning that lesson every time something like this happens. And sort of having those same conversations, which I think are valuable to have. I just wonder when it's going to stick, you know, and what do we do with that? Like, what's really our takeaway? Because you want there to be some kind of lesson coming out of this, you know, rather tragic ending to a person's life, but life doesn't often conform to that narrative. So I don't know, man, just appreciate, what he brought to us. And, yeah, it's a great loss. You know, 61 years old is not old by any means.
No,
no.
Scott, you got anything to add about, Anthony Bourdain?
I'm looking at something else here. Steve and Tim did just as great. I didn't watch a lot of his shows. I thought he was kind of a dick.
But I can see how he would come across that way.
Yeah.
The guy, the Man versus Food guy said it, that Anthony Bourdain hated ketchup. I know that. And I know that he had he had issues. It's sad. It really is sad. And maybe it woke up, you know. And then, of course, we'll be talking about another suicide death that was very close to his. In fact, I think it was the same day or the day before or whatever. But it's very sad. And it's still a problem in this country, and needs to, you know, maybe sometimes it cries for help when something like that happens. Maybe it does. Maybe it doesn't. But I didn't watch a ton of his shows, but. I think that was his whole personality, but I can't echo. I echo what Steve and Tim said. Just a tough loss for not only the TV world, but of course his family as well. Well, he'll be missed.
Yeah. So rest in peace, Anthony. Tim. So back on May 13th, we lost Margot Kidder at the age of 69. So you want to talk a little bit about Margot?
Yeah, I think, let me just try to start off light, okay?
Okay.
I was going to open my thoughts on Margot Kidder by remarking on the somewhat sad coincidence that was her death and someone else we're going to be talking about, Neil Simon, in the same year. And then I remembered that Neil Simon is not Paul Simon, and that Margot Kidder is not Carrie Fisher, who died in 2016. I promise I know who Margot Kidder is, and I promise I know who Carrie Fisher is, but it was just that weird intersection for a second where, you know, their lives overlap in some ways, even though their careers did not, if that makes sense. I think immediately the role that comes to mind when we talk Margot Kidder is going to be Lois Lane, right?
Yeah.
So to me, she has always been my favorite Lois. I mean, certainly my first Lois Lane, and you know, that 1978 Superman would have been one of the first, you know, just full length movies I remember seeing, not in the theater, just movies period. And you know, I'm sure that has a lot to do with it, as much as I've watched and rewatched that, really got burned into my mind that she was Lois, and I don't think that will ever change. And she had a kind of a rocky career from that point forward. You would think that would be a big breakout role, or a springboard to greater success. And when you look at her other roles, either for film or television, it's kind of all over the place. And, you know, she has said that she's not someone who was particularly choosy about which parts she would take. So it's not even so much, she didn't pick great scripts, which is a thing that absolutely happens, but she just wasn't picky at all. She just wanted to work, and I think liked the occupation of acting. And I sort of dig that she just wasn't precious about it at all. I mean, how many actors, sit down, do the inside the actor studio thing where they're just so up their own asses about what they do. Some with good reason, others not. And she's just somebody who's like, yeah, I liked the money. I liked acting. I didn't totally love the industry, but I did what I had to do to earn a living. Was certainly dogged later in life by some mental health issues, but also is notable for her activism. Something I did not realize before kind of preparing for this podcast is that she was living in Montana, living just outside of Billings, Montana at the time of her death, and stood with the Standing Rock protesters, just a couple years before her death. And that's not something that was well publicized. And in some ways, it's alluded to that perhaps contributing to some health problems that she may have been turning to chemical means to cope with. I know her death was ruled a suicide, like Anthony Bourdain, described as a result of self-inflicted drug and alcohol use. Seems like that would be difficult to pin down, whether this is an accidental thing or an intentional thing, but apparently that's what the coroner came away with. And I don't know, another one of those pretty unfortunate endings to a life that was a little bit chaotic. She's one of those people that you were sort of rooting for, hoped would have that resurgence. I mentioned Carrie Fisher. I would have loved to see them do like a team up, do a show like in the vein of a Grace and Frankie, or hell, even give them a talk show or something. I just think they would have, both been able to play off of each other so great. And I don't know why I just think of the two of them almost in the same vein, but that's my somewhat scattershot thoughts on Margot Kidder. She was quite the character, and not that I've seen a lot of her in recent years, but I feel like it's fair to say we'll still be missed.
Oh yeah, I wholeheartedly agree that she was the best Lois Lane that we've seen. I mean, she had such, that iconic scene of her falling in the first Superman movie, when she gets caught by Superman and he's like, I got you. And she's like, you got me. Who's got you?
Who's got you?
That's one of the most iconic things from that whole movie. And as much as I love Christopher Reeve, it was her and Gene Hackman as Lex Luthor that stole that movie. But, she was really, her and Carrie Fisher, yeah, they must have been some, I'm sure they were friends. They must have been some pair. I mean, if you seek out Wishful Drinking, if you want to see some great Carrie Fisher, that one woman, like, monologue-y type thing. But Margot Kidder, yeah, she battled bipolar disorder, and, they found her in somebody's garden once and claiming she was attacked.
In the mid-90s.
Yeah. I will point to, I don't know if you guys watched Will and Grace during its initial run, but she had a recurring role as a acting teacher of Jack's. And she was just hysterical. One of the best characters, who I think, Sean Hayes' Jack is just so over the top and just really funny with great comedic timing, that she played off of him so beautifully and set the table for him to be just all weird. And she would just bring him back down to earth.
Yeah. So, that performance was so, the Jack performance in Will and Grace was kind of so, broad and extra that if someone else can stand out in a scene with him, kind of to their credit.
Yes, it's Margot Kidder. Scott, what about Margot for you?
She will always be Lois. And one of my favorite appearances for her in her later life, and this happened after she had her 90s issues, is, and they did this a lot on this show, Christopher Reeve was on as well, is she made an appearance on Smallville, mm-hmm. which was very fitting because obviously Smallville, mm-hmm. As was Christopher Reeve. And she was, I think she was a reporter or an editor for the paper that Clark, Tom Welling, was working for after he left school. I'm pretty sure that's what it was. And it was pretty cool. Like that's why I love that show. We were all in the chat last night, and we were in our chat. We were talking about like all our favorite shows, and that's one that I actually didn't mention. And I'm actually, thanks to a certain person on the show, I have all 10 seasons on my shelf here, and here in Studio B. And it's arguably one of my favorite shows ever, because I think it's a great depiction of the Superman story without boring anybody. And she was in it, and I thought it was a great. I don't watch Will and Grace, so I didn't see that. I know she was on it. But that to me was almost like a personal success for her, to be able to come back. Cause I remember reading the stuff in the 90s and she looked awful and she was like all emaciated and she was a dumpster fire. And to be able to rebound and come back and be able to do some acting again really was a great personal triumph for her. And for us as fans to see her succeed again. And it's sad to see her go. But she will – hey, look at it. The two stars of those movies are both gone.
Yeah.
Well too soon. Much too soon.
Yep. Hard to believe.
Very hard to believe. I agree, Tim. And she is iconic. I mean, a lot of people – I don't remember her name, but I know before the movies, a lot of people remember the woman that played – Lois on the George Reeves TV series in the early mid to mid 50s before he died tragically. There's not much more to say. I mean, I'll give the floor to Steve. She was a tremendous actress who gave Lois that combination of strength but vulnerability at the same time. And I'm sure it was, I mean, there were a lot of people. If you watch the doc, in fact, your network, Mr. Atherton, did that documentary on about Superman with that guy whose name shall not be named, Kevin Spacey, and he
that's right. It.
And they were talking about it's actually on one of the I think it's on the DC Universe app. It is actually that documentary, and they talked about all the different women that went for that role: Leslie Ann Warren. Who else? Oh God, a couple of other actresses. And they didn't fit until Margot Kidder, and she had that perfect combination of strength and vulnerability that fit the movie, which it needed to fit. This movie had to be great with all the money that the Saul Kinds were putting in, and you know Richard Donner probably didn't come cheap. That movie kind of had to be perfect, and it was. They weren't as good after that. Two was good. Three was okay. Four sucked, but that first one needed to be perfect, and that's why Margot Kidder deserves a ton of credit for making that movie succeed.
Steve,
I really can't add much to Margot except obviously the only way I really knew of her was from Superman, which just shows what kind of an iconic role it is because that sticks in your head. Like if anyone ever asked me asked that question, who is Lois Lane? I mean, Margot Kidder is the one, even more than Terry Hatcher. She was Lois Lane in the show, right? Dean Cain?
Yeah, Terry Hatcher was in Lois and Clark.
Yep.
Margot Kidder also in the original Amityville Horror in 1979.
Yes, she was. Yes, she was, Tim.
Thank you for saving us from getting corrected by Jason Sherman. Thank you.
Well, a film in retrospect, she referred to as a, quote, piece of shit. So, it's been a long time since I saw that. But nice to see that kind of honesty reflected in her.
It's funny because
use of her performances.
Yeah, which is funny because I thought she was great in it, actually, now that I think about it.
Yeah.
I mean, it was her, James Brolin, Rod Steiger was the priest. It's a tremendous movie. I was always kind of perplexed that she thought that way because I thought she was tremendous in it. Yeah. Actually, good call, yeah. Tim, to mention that. I totally forgot about that. Yeah, she was great in that. I was kind of perplexed when she used to say that, but
love it.
Weird. That's her for her. God bless you, Margo.
Yep.
Anything else, Steve?
That is all.
That is all. That's what we like about you, Steve.
Steve's in the Appleton Horror.
Every day. So, number one drunkest city in America, folks.
Oh,
just announced. Congrats.
Woo! Something to be proud of.
All right. So so back on April 15th, at the age of 74, we lost Arlie Ermey. So most people know him from Full Metal Jacket as the drill sergeant, given all the nicknames and just yelling and screaming at Vincent D'Onofrio and Matthew Modine. And it was really a great movie. I mean, you know, he actually was a staff sergeant and gunnery, actually sergeant in the Marine Corps. He served 14 months in Vietnam and did two tours in Okinawa, Japan, after injuries forced him, I believe, to have an honorable discharge. As my page is loading here. He retired from the Corps and then studied criminology and drama at the University of Manila in the Philippines. You know, and besides Full Metal Jacket, you know, he's known. He was in Seven as a police captain. He was in Mississippi Burning, which I've a long time ago I seen, but it's a really great film if you haven't already seen it, with you know, Gene Hackman, William Dafoe, about the about down in the South, I believe about a murder during the time of segregation. And then also a very funny comedic turn in Saving Silverman as the coach who you know wants to kill Amanda Pete for the boys. And then also in the Toy Story movie, the first three. I'm not sure if he was able to record his voice before he passed away, if he played the you know, the army men sergeant, which, you know, they couldn't really get anybody else to do that. And then on one of my channels, as you would say, Scott, on the History Channel, he hosted two shows, Mail Call and Lock and Load. Mail Call was basically he would answer viewer questions, and Lock and Load was all about, like, artillery and different weapons. So so Arlie Ermey, you know, was quite the character, probably somebody to have one hell of a drinking night with, I can imagine. But Tim, any Arlie Ermey thoughts?
Somebody who was typecast throughout his entire career, basically, but you can sort of see for good reason. but I guess, you know, I can't add too much to what you said other than what a shift to go from, just in terms of occupations and what your life is like, to be in the armed forces, in the position he was in, and then to become an actor. And I don't know, that's just such a massive pivot that it's a lot for one lifetime. So, yeah, wow. He did a ton of shit. I'm just looking at his filmography, and the man was extremely active. So He certainly embraced his new career.
Yeah. Steve, any thoughts?
I know him from Full Metal Jacket. When I went to school, we had to take a arts class in college, and so I took a film course, and we had to write a paper on one movie, and I chose Full Metal Jacket. And it was cool doing a deep dive into that movie and really exploring, you know, the themes of, especially the first half of the movie, with like the kind of the masculinity, and his character was, gosh, I would have to say the archetype for, you know, the hard ass drill sergeant. There's no one who can come close to the way he played that.
Oh yeah, that's actually two movies, and unfortunate he doesn't make it to the second half of the movie. But yeah, mm-hmm. it's a performance that just, you know, between him and Vincent D'Onofrio, just those scenes, you know, are just incredible. Scott,
yeah,
you have something, anything to add?
Yes, I'm going to tell you, Mr. Atherton, what is your major malfunction, numbnuts? You know, the great thing about Ermy was that he the performance in Full Metal Jacket, which is probably one of my probably five or top five or six favorite war movies of all time. He got to improvise. So I believe What Is Your Major Malfunction, Numbnuts, was an audible,
an ad lib.
And he was also very good, and he did not need a lot of takes for scenes, which is very rare for a Kubrick movie, because Kubrick apparently was a colossal pain in the ass a lot of times, and liked retakes. He drove Shelley Duvall pretty much out of acting.
Yeah, like fucking with people too.
Yeah, he big time fucked. Well, that's why Shelley Duvall pretty much never acted again after The Shining, because he drove her fucking crazy.
Yeah.
Well, didn't she do Popeye?
Then Olive Oil, and that movie drove anybody not to act anymore. Thank God Robin Williams blew it off and moved on with his great career. But
a little known or little remembered HBO kids show. That's right.
Oh, yeah.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yep.
Huh.
I think it was about Nursery
Rhymes. Fraggle Rock?
Yeah, she played like...
It was similar.
Yeah, very she similar. Had like a hat on and like an old timey, like a Mother Goose type character.
Fairy Tale Theater.
Yeah. Yep. Yes.
Wow, I do not remember that. All I ever knew her in was The Shining and Popeye. But anyway, my point.
Rest in peace, Shelley Duvall.
Yeah, rest in peace, Shelley Duvall. Yeah, she passed away. I don't know if it was this year, a couple years ago, I think. But my point is historically, you can ask a lot of guys. Malcolm McDowell, Stanley Kubrick was a pain in the ass, and as Tim said, he was a little weird. But Ermy pretty much put him in his – I don't want to say put him in his place, but proved to him that he can get shit done quick. And his Marine-type efficiency was unprecedented for a Stanley Kubrick movie. And he deserves all the credit for that. And his performance was tremendous. He did not – according to his filmography, Andy, he did not make it to do Toy Story 4. So which is a bummer.
Yeah, I was just going to say that Shelley Duvall, we have unfortunately killed her off prematurely.
Oh, really?
I was trying to do it off mic.
I thought I was making a joke, and then Scott was like, yeah, rest in peace. I was like, maybe she did die. I thought she didn't.
Oh, my God. Look at that when you're Popeye.
Towards his later years, and I didn't realize that he was, man, I've already lost it, Leaving Las Vegas, which is one of the best depressing movies of all time.
Yeah. Oh my God! Yeah,
it's so good, but you can't watch it more than once. I tried, and yeah, it is. And also, this will relate to someone I'm going to talk about later: the Steve Prefontaine movie, Prefontaine, about the famous runner from the '70s. He played Bill Bowerman, the starter of Nike. So random, because every single thing is sheriff, senator, you know, military, police,
right. Coach,
yeah, Nike. Like the guy who invented the wobble shoe. Track shoes, pretty much. He invented them.
That's totally wrong. How old is Shelley Duvall anyway?
I'm sorry. I'm still stuck on the Shelley Duvall thing.
Yes. Thanks for killing her. Thanks for throwing me that curveball, Tim. Hey, you know what? Ray Walston rebounded from being the Commodore in Popeye to being Mr. Hand on Fast Times at Ridgemont High. So.
R.I.P. Ray Walston.
Yeah. But shut up.
He's actually dead. Mr. Hand.
She's 69. All right, so she's not that old. All right, she was married to Paul Simon.
Wow. Who was also not Neil Simon.
Who wasn't married to Paul Simon?
Also not Simon Le Bon. Shout out Jason Sherman.
That's two.
Simon Le Bon, still alive.
You know he's going to be messaging all of us.
Yeah, although he has a kill.
All right.
I'm going to be all in on bad puns tonight.
Yeah, we are. We're just burying Ermy even more and more. I hate bad puns, numb nuts.
Don Rickles, yeah, they laugh and enjoy people.
I mean, I watched some of Mail. What was it called? Mailbag.
There was Mail Call, and then
Mail Call.
Yeah, and then there was the I just had Lock and Load.
Lock and Load. No, I remember watching Mail Call, but I did like Full Metal Jacket. He was incredible in that, but. But I think the great thing to remember about him is he actually kind of put Stanley Kubrick in his place. Could you imagine telling him, look, Creepshow, you're not going to act weird with me.
Your Stanley Kubrick sounds just like your Vince McMahon.
No, that was Ermy talking to Kubrick. I know, right? You're fired, Kubrick. No. No, rest in peace, Arlie Ermey, who I believe is dead. Okay. yeah. so, yeah, no, great career. And a wonderful man and a soldier. And mm-hmm. we thank him for his service. He is buried at Arlington, and he deserves to be buried in Arlington. So, yeah, God rest his soul.
All right. So we're going to pause for these in-depth eulogies, I guess you want to call them, and just mention some honorable mentions here. So I'm just going to read off the list. You guys have something you want to say about any of these names, just, you know, feel free. Scott Wilson, the actor best known in recent time as Herschel from The Walking Dead. Actually, Herschel appeared in a, I don't know if it was a flashback, a dream sequence, a fever dream, on one of the last episodes in this past season, right before he died. So thankfully they were able to dedicate the episode to him and everything. Marty Balin, he was Balin of Jefferson Airplane, Jefferson Starship fame.
And arguably one of the greatest Yacht Rock songs of all time.
Yes, Yacht Rock.
Is everything all right? Hearts, of course. Tremendous song.
And then Bill Daly, I guess the friend, the second banana, I guess, on I Dream of Jeannie. Robin Leach, host of the Lifestyles of Rich and Famous. You know, you didn't grow up in the 80s and 90s and not know who Robin Leach was. Kate Spade, the fashion designer, passed away, unfortunately, another suicide. Jerry Van Dyke, from first known as My Mother, the Car, and then Luther on Coach.
Oh, yes. Oh, so sad. So sad, Luther.
And then
they can't do a reboot show. They can't reboot it, I guess.
Well, maybe they could have his son or something.
Right.
Then the great character actor David Ogden Stiers, mm-hmm. who's from MASH, Doc Hollywood, Beauty and the Beast, Pocahontas, did a lot of great voices. Keith Jackson, the great, was it Scott College football commentator?
Keith Jackson was the voice of, well, he was one of the greatest broadcasters ever, mostly for college football.
Touchdown, Alabama.
Alabama. He was the voice of the Rose Bowl for many, many, many years. But he did some baseball. He did some NFL throughout his great career. But for the most part, he's mostly known for college football and one of the greatest play-by-play guys of all time. Very sad. Oh. I mean, he'd retired. He hadn't done games for probably about 10 years. Yeah, very sad. Very sad.
All right. And then we had Reg E. Cathy. He was the a great character actor from movies such as SWAT, The Mask, The Fantastic Four. And he was Luke Cage's dad on the now canceled Netflix series. Mm-hmm. Vic Damone, the great singer slash crooner. Milos Forman, who won Best Director for One Flew Over Cuckoo's Nest.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Also directed Amadeus, People versus Larry Flint, and Hair. Mm. Avicii, the rapper, DJ, singer, did the song Wake Me Up, if you guys are familiar.
And I probably heard more of his songs than I'd care to admit.
Well, Wake Me Up When It's Not Over.
Yep.
The great television producer Stephen Bochco of Hill Street Blues, L.A. Law, NYPD Blue, and Murder One fame. And then, Steve, you wanted to talk about Roger Bannister.
Yeah, and I'm going to give Scott a trivia question because he always puts me on the spot on Main Event about something similar.
Okay.
So Roger Bannister, known as most famous for breaking the 4-minute mile, first person to ever do it in the 50s. And Scott, you started quizzing our buddy Nate and I who is on the cover of Sports Illustrated for a given date. And yes. What does Roger Bannister have to do with Sports Illustrated?
What does he have to do with Sports Illustrated?
Yes. First man to break the 4-minute mile.
Correct.
That wasn't the question.
What does he have to do with?
Tim knows, but I'm not going to ask him.
Yeah, I know.
What's he have to do with? The only thing I could think of is, 54. Was he the first sports person of the year?
Very good. Yes, he was.
Oh, there we go. Okay.
Yeah, first ever sports person of the year.
Yep.
He was also their first centerfold to go full frontal in a split.
Yes. Yes. Well, I mean, the thing was, like, even though he wasn't a hurdler, they had that hurdle perfectly placed because, you know, scandalous. But even to this day, like, if you break a 4-minute mile, that is like you are an absolute elite track star. You're an elite runner. And what I didn't know about him, I knew he was a doctor, but I didn't know that shortly after that race, he quit. He retired from running. And so he can concentrate on being a doctor and probably ended up being more, I wouldn't say famous, but more important in his career as a doctor in terms of how celebrated he was and how much he did. So pretty good. I mean, you don't see many top-notch athletes walking away to become a physician.
Yeah. Wow.
Amazing.
Yeah. So we're going to move on with the show. So we lost a couple this year. Back in April, at the age of 92, former First Lady and mother of a president, Barbara Bush, passed away at the age of 92. And then her husband, George H.W. Bush, on November 30th, passed away at the age of 94. So we'll start with Tim about the Bushes.
Yes, opportunity to take these two together, which seems appropriate. Mm-hmm. I'll never forget the time George Bush barfed in the Japanese prime minister's lap. towards the end of his presidency, just one of those, I don't remember how old I was, but I just remember that being all, like, you could not escape it. And, I mean, it's the type of thing that if it happened today, it would be a much different situation, but could all sort of laugh about it at the time. On a more serious note, George H.W. Bush, he was not the first president that I can recall in my lifetime, but he was like my first civics lesson in a way, because he was president when I learned that elections were a thing and that we voted these people into office. And in fact, I do remember accompanying my grandmother to the polling place in 1988. She voted for Dukakis, but that's beside the point. but that's sort of like, oh, this is how this whole process works. I remember we held a mock election in my elementary school in 92. Don't remember who won, but I think it was George Bush. I think I voted for him anyway in that mock election. And he's notable as well for being the only one-term president in my lifetime, which feels very weird. You know, I'm 35 years old, and that's just sort of astonishing to me. And the thing of it is, and I'm not going to get political here or anything, it's just that he was voted out of office in 92, not because of some great big ethical lapse, no egregious mismanagement of the nation's welfare, or, you know, because of his character just as a human being. I think most people lay the cause of his defeat in 92 at, you know, reneging on a campaign promise. Granted, a pretty big promise, but just imagine that. Just like how quaint that sounds today. Mm-hmm. Holding a politician and an American president to account, just taking them at their word. And so I'm not even saying he was a bad president, that I think he was a bad president, but if you are someone who holds the opinion that he was a bad president, he sort of makes you long for the days when we could have, in theory, just a regular bad president. It didn't, I know that sounds like damning with faint praise. It's really not. It just goes to show that there was a time when it didn't have to be a reflection on this person's patriotism or, again, their character as a human being. that you could just respect the effort that was put forth and the intentions. And if you didn't like the job you did, you voted him out. We all moved on with our lives. It just feels like the American people that George Bush represented is not really the same America that's represented today, and we've just sort of lost something. And as for Barbara, I don't know how to say it. She could sort of slit your throat with the kindest words. Just she wasn't particularly opinionated in her position as first lady. She tended to be pretty uncontroversial, especially in comparison to her predecessor and successor. Not that there's anything wrong with that. I think she was no less visible than both, you know, Nancy Reagan and Hillary Rodham Clinton. And I mean, she advocated for children's literacy. I mean, how bipartisan can you get? So I think she had a vision for what the post of first lady represented and executed it very well. And there, you know, the Bushes are sort of can sort of be looked to as a certain model of what a post-presidential career looks like for a president, a former president and first lady. So yeah, it wasn't terribly surprising that they kind of went as soon in succession to one another as they did. I think that's very much a phenomenon that's been studied, that especially, gosh, how many years were they married? Both of them in their 90s. And as soon as Barbara went, I think everyone kind of said, well, George is not going to be much longer for this world. And, you know, they lived a very, very long life and have quite the legacy. So I think I've said enough. I will turn it over to the panel.
All right. Steve, your thought on the Bushes.
So Reagan was the first president that I can recall, but I would say that Bush was the first election that I really understood what was going on. I remember when he was, indicted, but that's what our current presidents, that's what we think about with our presidents these days, from Clinton on. When he was brought into office, I remember that being played over the loudspeaker at school. And I don't know, like, I think more of him post-presidency, where it started with his points of light speech during his presidency, where he was really focusing on volunteerism and the power of the everyday person to make change in a better way. And after his presidency, how that was... that was what he did. That was what he pushed and portrayed. And he's probably, you know, Tim, you mentioned it, that he was more of a bipartisan president, you know, a Republican, you know, on the right, but was willing to work with Democrats in a way that we just don't see that bipartisanship anymore. And so one of the more, I would say, beloved presidents after his term. Always very much, especially the last few years, you see him with the Obamas, with the Clintons. Whenever there's a big to-do, they were all together. And Michelle Obama said that he was one of her close friends, just to show that kind of, you know, I think that's the big lesson that I took when I was looking back at his career. And, you know, I don't agree with all of his policies. I agree with some, like he was the person assigned the Disabilities Act into, you know, in, I think it was 90, where they did the America's with Disabilities Act.
I think so. Yeah, I think you're right. I think it is 90.
And then signed a lot with civil rights as well. But, you know, and he also was involved in a lot of wars that I didn't necessarily agree with. You know, some I did, some I didn't. Kind of an interesting mix, but I really respect him more for everything that he did afterwards that I know of. And I know he had a very storied military career as well. So very interesting president. Just a lot. I remember, I think it was, he was 90 or 85 that he parachuted out of a plane, which is like ridiculous.
Like, he did it every year, like the last 8 years of his life, or every 5 years, every 5 years, starting when he was, I think, 70.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, I can't, my mom's not even 70. I can't even get her to take a walk.
Yeah, a big sports fan too, right? He he played football, I think, for Yale, right? And he's a baseball guy, you know.
Baseball fan. Always at the was it the Astros games or was no the Rangers games? One of the two. Astros, Rangers.
Astros. His son owned the Rangers, but he was the Astros. That's right.
Yeah, I mean, I remember some of the phrases, you know, about him not liking broccoli. One of the best, you know, was known as a, you know, they referred to him as a wimp often back then, but he wasn't at all. And
which again sounds very weird.
Yeah,
looking back.
Well, I mean, I think Reagan had such a presence, you know, so that after he came after Reagan, and. Yeah. You know, Reagan, like, you know, he was an actor. He was good on TV, you know, not everybody, you know, has that, you know. And incredibly funny, hysterically parodied by Dana Carvey on Saturday Night Live.
Oh, God, yeah. One of the all-time best impersonations.
Mm-hmm. Not going to do it. Not going to do it. Not really Bush prudent at this juncture.
Sure.
And John Lovitz as Dukakis. I can't believe I'm losing this guy. Yeah. But Scott, give some your thoughts on the couple of the Bushes.
Well, the first president I remember was actually Carter.
Yeah, me too.
Get mad because Carter used to cut off Sesame Street. Maybe that's probably why I love Reagan so much, because he used to do his stuff at night when I went to bed. But damn it, Jimmy, you drunken peanut farmer's brother. Anyway,
build some houses for the poor or something.
Yeah, exactly. Go hang out with dictators. No, I'm only kidding. No,
and let's school children about being the Malays and everything, right?
Yes.
And soon to be
your
the
your life suck.
And Jimmy Carter soon to be, I think in March, if he lives till March, he'll become the oldest president to have ever lived. George H.W. actually was.
Yeah.
So, Scott, go ahead.
Yep. So I remember. I was the peak of my childhood was the Reagan Bush years. I mean, I was 7 when Reagan won in 1980. So I was in high school when Bush won in 88. And I admired the man a lot. I admired Reagan as well. And I think that the whole wimp thing used to make me laugh, because a lot of people didn't know a lot about Bush's life before he was president. But this guy was the head of the CIA.
Yeah.
All right. You don't want to crack that head open, because I don't think anybody would ever, including me, would ever want the stomach to see what that guy had to look at during his time in the CIA. Believe me. So that guy was far from a wimp, let me tell you.
I can't talk about knowing where the bodies are buried.
Yeah, exactly. But he was also the first vice president to ever have to be acting president. July 13th, 1985. Actually, the same day as Live Aid, which is pretty funny. When Reagan had surgery to remove polyps from his colon, he was under, and technically he was president for 8 hours. Actually,
was
he didn't count
when Reagan
was
shot.
I don't think so. It doesn't say it on here.
I think it was on my 5th birthday.
Yeah, it doesn't say it on here. Clearly. It says on July 13th, 1985, Bush became the first vice president to serve as acting president when Reagan underwent surgery to remove polyps from his colon. He was acting president for 8 hours. So I don't know if he actually was. Reagan was shot in the stage situation room. Availability of nuclear football and Bush's plane landed. He was advised by his aides to proceed directly to the White House by copter. An image of the government still functioning. Only the president lands. Bush rejected the idea of responding. Only the president. And here's a great sign of respect. Only the president lands on the South Lawn. That made a positive impression on Reagan, who recovered, turned to work in 2 weeks. Blah blah blah. The two men would have regular Thursday lunches in the Oval. Because they were very. It was very touchy. Because remember, Bush ran against him in the primaries in 1980.
And was beating him for a while.
So they became very close, as Reagan's two terms had progressed. But I remember Bush being a very straight up guy. He kind of put what I remember in high school, he put a nice bow on the end of communism and the knocking down the wall and the Soviet Union becoming Russia again and an open country as best as it could be, I suppose. What I remember about when he lost, you talk about one-term presidents, Tim, and we haven't had a less than a two since. Two things. Yes, the no new taxes killed him. Any Republican that has to raise taxes usually means the end of anything.
Which sucks because he had to.
Yeah.
He really didn't have a choice.
Yeah, he really had no choice. Yeah. He had no choice. The other thing was, and I remember this very vividly, and I said this to my dad. This happened late 91, early 92, so I was in college by then. After the Rodney King verdict and L.A. burned to the ground, Bush went to walk through Compton and walk through Watts and through the parts of South Central that were completely rubble. And I remember actually saying, I'm saying this, and I turned to my father. I said, I think Bush is going to lose in November. And he goes, why do you think that? He says, because he doesn't look relatable here. Here's a guy, grew up his father was a senator here down in the Stamford Greenwich section of Connecticut, went to Yale, you know, had houses in Maine, you know, typical, good life, earned, nothing handed to him, yet walking through like an area he probably would never walk through otherwise. And I think he was not relatable on TV. Plus suddenly youth was taking over and everybody wanted hip, cool Bill Clinton to be president. So that's what happened. And Bush just kind of quietly went into retirement, supported his son, who had a hit or miss presidency, and eventually just became a good ambassador for the country. Became very close with Clinton after Katrina, and they had that fund that they did those commercials together, the PSAs together. Bush just cared about doing the right thing. And that's why he became close with the Clintons and became very close with the Obamas. In fact, I think little W and Michelle are like, I don't know, maybe they're having an affair. They're like best friends right now. It's kind of ridiculous considering your husband kind of laid into him a little bit at the beginning of his term, which is pretty funny. But and I just found this out very recently. And I'm not surprised because their relationship was never great. But Daddy Bush actually voted for Hillary in 2016.
Yeah.
Which I was blown away by that. Which tells you the relationship that the Bush family has with our current
president. They hate the Trumps. Yeah.
No, he was and Trump was an unforgiving douche a lot of times to the family anyway. But that's neither here nor there. I don't want to get into that right now. That's not part of our discussion today. But I'll always remember Bush as a straight up honest guy who had to see a lot of things in his life that none of us probably have the stomach to see. And just wanted to do what was good for the country and made tough decisions that he didn't want to have to do. And we talked about the recession in 90, 91. My father lost his job and I was going to a private. And this is why I always will respect my father and any other fathers that are like this. I went to a parochial Catholic school, high school. So I had a tuition. I didn't go to public school. And my father lost his job during the recession. And my dad, I thought to myself, oh, shit, I'm going to get yanked out of here. My senior year in high school, I'm going to have to go to a public high school. And my high school in my hometown is fucking garbage. So I thought I was fucked. Nope. My father worked at Domino's for 6 months to deliver pizzas to keep me in parochial school. And he goes, that's because that's what our president would have wanted, to not sit around and wait for anything. He got up and he did the right thing. And I'll always respect that out of my dad. And Reagan was the same way. So I always felt that special bond to Bush because he had to do very tough things during a time when the country needed it, and it ultimately probably led to his defeat. So I'll always respect that about him. But to find out that he voted for Hillary, actually, I almost choked on I was eating something, almost choked on my hot dog when I heard that. But you know what? He voted for who he thought was the right candidate. Either was right, but that's a different story for another day. But he was a great man, and Barbara was probably one of the more. You said it right. A good thing, Tim. Probably one of the more elegant first ladies. She didn't get in the way. She was what normal first ladies are. She doesn't. Mm-hmm. She lets her husband handle the president handled the tough stuff. She handles education, and she went out there in the community with the kids. Laura Bush was a lot like that. Michelle is a lot like that. And I always respected that about her. And she had, you know, she had mostly good kids. Look, little George had his issues as a when he was younger, somehow became president. Jeb became a governor, almost a president. She had wonderful grandkids. I mean, they were a good family, honest. You know, they were a straight up family, good Americans. And by the way, Bush was actually the last president to serve in a war. That speaks volumes too, based on generations. You know, so anyway, a wonderful man who lived a great life, a charmed life, both of them, and they'll be missed. And now we have only four living presidents left. Jimmy Carter is pretty close, though. He's what, 95?
He's up there.
Yeah, he's up there.
Let me see. I think I just had it up. Let me take a look. I think he was 90. I think he's 95.
94, 95, yeah.
Let's see. Anyway, yeah. So, sorry about that. I didn't mean to go that long. But
that's all right. That's, you know, we're here to, you know.
I had my Bush Quail sticker on my notebook when I was a kid, only because my friend worked at the campaign. But I liked you, Tim. I liked him. What would you say? Was your grandmother that voted for Dukakis? Is that what your grandmother said?
Yes, my grandmother voted for Dukakis.
that's right.
She was the one.
In 84, my mom voted for Mondale, and I said, you should have your voting rights taken away from you.
I'm sure she voted for Mondale, too. That is no doubt in my mind. But look, I mean, Bush 41, agree with his politics or not. I mean, you can never really question his patriotism, and that kind of speaks volumes today.
Yeah. Yeah, and I don't think there's a lot of presidents.
It's sort of a low bar, but honestly, it says a lot right now.
Yeah, exactly. Sorry, Andy, we kind of went a little long on Dub H Dub, but I know we got more to go. So,
well, it was a twofer, so it was okay.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. So I'm going to talk about somebody we lost back on April 16th at the age of 65, relatively young. You know, Harry Anderson. The very funny comedian, actor, television star, you know, first saw him on a Young Comedian special, I think, doing like, you know, some of those magic tricks and comedy. But, you know, his first big TV role, he was Harry the Hat on Cheers, was a kind of a con man, would show up at the bar and try to, you know, get people out of their money and stuff like that. Coach often fell for it. God bless him. But really, the role he's most known for is the Honorable Judge Harold T. Stone on Night Court. Very, very funny show. I got the pleasure of having to format many of those when they were in syndication and reruns on one of the channels I work for. Also introduced a generation to the crooner Mel Torme, who most of us might not have even known who it was. You know, and then also then went on to star as in the title character of Dave Barry, the famed, I think it was a cartoonist, humorist, on Dave's World. So, he was only 65 when he passed away, which was a little young, you know, in my book. Steve, you want to talk about Harry Anderson? You got any thoughts?
Yeah, Night Court was on generally late for me when I was a kid. And so I remember.
Well, it was Night Court, Steve.
You're right. You're right.
If they do reruns during the day, it wouldn't have fit.
Yeah, that's not in syndication anymore.
Well, after Jimmy Carter broke through Sesame Street.
Yes.
Exactly, yes.
On PBS.
That's right.
So when I was a kid, I lived in a one-story home, and I could hear the TV. So Night Court was one that I would enjoy listening to. I obviously could not watch it, but it was one that I would try to stay up for and listen, because even just hearing the audio of it, there were so many brilliant comedians on that show that it was worth a listen, as I'd say. So it's like trying to purposely stay up as long as I can, so I'd be able to hear that. It was usually on after Cheers, right?
Yes. Night Court, yeah.
Thursday. Yep.
Mm-hmm. It was during the original must-see TV run, like Cosby, you know, Different World, Cheers, all that, yeah.
Yep. And not just brought people to understand Torme. Like, I remember a lot of magic and stuff as well. He not even an amateur magician, a legit professional magician.
Yeah, it was once was reportedly a three-card Monty dealer on the streets of New York at one point.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wouldn't surprise me. Yeah. I'll say quick. I don't have much to say. I'll just say quickly. He was an awesome actor. He was funny. And it was a good show. I'll leave it at that.
Okay. Tim.
Try to make it brief. Sorry, Steve. Were you done?
There's a first time for everything. Tim.
Night Court was a super underrated show. I mean, maybe not at the time, but I feel like it's sort of been forgotten since then. And that's too bad. Somewhat similar to Steve, I have a childhood, not story, but the same daycare where I saw RoboCop as a child.
When I was 4 years old. A callback to Talking Pop episode?
Yeah. Yes, a callback to Talking Pop, our last episode, getting you through the holidays. For some reason, I believe Night Court was in syndication like during the day, during the middle of the day, and we would watch that in the big media room in that daycare. Unless they recorded it and like showed it on tape, which is not entirely out of the realm of possibility. It was a strange daycare. But yeah, that was how I encountered Night Court and preferred to consume it. And that's all.
Right. Yeah, it was a very funny show. He was really funny. I mean, he was kind of overshadowed a little bit on that show because of some of the other characters. And they were like, you know, John Larroquette, who won, I think, 3 Emmys, I think, in a row, maybe, for portraying Dan Feeling. And then you had Richard Mall. And then it was also the show with, like, kind of like the cursed elderly female bailiffs that kept passing away. The first one was, I think it was, like, Selma. She died after one season, then they had Flo. She died after one season, they're like, fuck it, we need somebody young. So that's when they hired Marshall Warfield.
I know, right?
Yeah.
It was crazy, right?
Yes. So
terrible cast choice.
Yeah.
All smokers.
Yeah.
Someone died of cancer after season 2, and she was chain smoking on the show and in real life. Whoop.
Yeah, that was Selma Diamond who talked like this.
Selma
like,
Diamond. I don't know what the other one's called.
Florence Pugh.
Requirements.
Let me see. Creative Arts Emmys, Primetime Emmys. Larroquette won in, 85, 86, and 88.
Okay.
Wow. No, so, actually, yes. 85, 86, and 88. He wasn't even nominated in 87. Maybe that season he wasn't on much. Harry was nominated twice.
Three times.
You just beat me to it.
I know. He was not. I wish I had Lionel's voice. He was nominated in 85 for lead actor and in 87, and he didn't win either. I'm curious to see who. Well, I won't go that far. I'll look it up while you talk so we don't do a my usual thing. But anyway.
Well, you get to keep talking because we're actually going to move on to Willie McCovey, who passed away on October 31st at the age of 80.
Oh, okay. So here were the nominees. It was Harry Anderson, Ted Danson, Bob Newhart for Newhart, Jack Warden for Crazy Like a Fox, and the winner was Robert Guillaume for Benson. That was the first time Harry Anderson was nominated for a Primetime Emmy. And he was nominated in 1987 and 86, three straight years. And he lost to they were all losing to the Michael J. Fox, Alex Keaton machine. Primetime Emmy, so no one was touching AP. Speaking of Reagan Bush lovers, he was not losing. Willie McCovey, he was to Willie Mays what Lou Gehrig was to Babe Ruth. He was kind of the forgotten guy on a ton of awesome New York / San Francisco Giants teams. His nickname was Stretch because he was a great first baseman. Played in the league for a long time, almost 21 years, from 1959 to 1980. Spent his entire career on the West Coast. Played for the Giants from 59 to 73. Then 2 years with San Diego and Oakland. And then finished his career 3 years in San Francisco. Retired in 1980. 22 years. 270, 521 homers, 1,555 ribbies, 18 grand slams, which is still a National League record, By the way, Lou Gehrig has the major league record, ironically, with 23. Hmm. Willie McCovey was obviously the recipient, probably a lot of good pitches, because when you saw the Say Hey Kid on deck, you weren't going to walk McCovey to get to arguably one of the two or three greatest living baseball players ever. The Giants and Dodgers had great wars back in those years in the 50s and 60s, first when they were, of course, here in the boroughs, and then when they moved out to the coast. Just a great player who doesn't get remembered much because he played with Willie Mays. And just a great player. Should not be forgotten on the West Coast. I'm pretty sure his 44 is retired by the Giants. I'm going to double check that.
Well, yeah, he was
1980. When he retired in 1980, they had retired his number two. So he was number 44. And, of course, for you younger fans out there who don't know who he is, he's the one that McCovey Cove is named after. Well, it's not AT&T Park in Sanford. They're a new sponsor this year. It's a company to be named later Park in San Francisco. But yeah, he was to Willie Mays what Lou Gehrig was to Babe Ruth, that second hitter that the superstar needed, or else maybe his numbers would not have been as good. So I think the only difference is that Babe Ruth batted third and Gehrig batted cleanup, and I'm pretty sure that Willie Mays batted cleanup and McCovey batted third. But just a great player, and will always be remembered as just one of the best pure first base hitters in the history of the game.
Maybe the Roger Maris to Willie Mays' Mickey Mantle?
That's actually a good comparison as well. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep, I agree.
Uh-huh. But yeah, he was a six-time All-Star. He was the National League Rookie of the Year in 1959, National League MVP in 1969. And Scott, what year was he elected to the Hall of Fame? Do you know that off the top of your head?
Well, probably 85, 5 years. He probably waited the full five and went in on his first year of eligibility, I'm assuming.
You were off by 1 year, 86.
Really? He didn't make it his first year? That's a bunch of horse shit. Then again, the voting in general is fucking horse shit. So
it was his first year.
Oh.
If you do the math, Andy, 81 to 85.
Yeah, and then 86 was the year he was voted. Yeah.
So we did the math right.
Okay.
The Hall of Fame voting is still horse shit, but that's probably a great debate topic for another show.
Oh, yeah.
16th player to do so, to be nominated, to be inducted in his first year.
You said what, the first person?
16th. Only the 16th player to be voted in his first year of eligibility.
Yeah, that's amazing. And he earned it. One of the greatest players of all time. Rest in peace.
Yeah. Steve, you have anything else to add besides that good tidbit?
No, I don't at all. Oh, yes, I do, actually. I have an even better tidbit.
Okay.
Willie McCovey is Todd Weber's boyhood idol. That is a fact. I just received that text.
That's awesome.
Well, being one of the newer hosts here on the Place to Be Nation pop feed, I was actually just finally tuned in that you have to mention Todd Weber on every show. So thank you for doing that.
Yeah. No problem. I didn't realize that was the case. I guess that's only on the pop feed, but I will try to do it more in my shows.
Okay.
I'm usually one to name Jordan Duncan on every show. So I'll have to remember to do that on this one.
Okay, you're in the only two-time guest on Great Debate so far. I have two episodes.
And how disgusting is this? My apologies, Tim. Give me
Jordan Duncan.
5 seconds.
Yeah.
he's a fucking disgrace in his own right. He was on 346 of 425 ballots the year that he made it. 81% The guy had 521 fucking home runs. 81%. That's just disgraceful.
It shows that even in the 80s, they had those writers who were just all curmudgeons. And
yeah.
Like, you have to earn it. Like, you don't earn it by waiting.
Right, I'm sure, like Hank Aaron's first year, there's some of those writers who don't do it for other non-baseball reasons.
I'm sure they're going to be assholes not voting for Mo this year.
One guy said he's not going to vote at all. Well, we're not going to get into that debate. Yeah. Tim, your thoughts on Willie McCovey?
He was a baseball guy, right?
All right, let's take a break here on this.
Wait, who's the host here?
Hey, look, you already failed with that curmudgeonly open, so you're lucky you're not going to fucking host school.
They don't know that it was take two.
I broke them. All right.
Okay.
Yes, Tim, he played baseball.
Okay. May he rest in peace.
All right, there you go.
There you go.
You're a great baseballist, I have no doubt.
Baseballist?
Yes.
Steve, I think you should start using that word. It will become part of the lexicon. If you start saying baseballist, I think it'll actually, people will actually believe it. Yes. I like that.
Listen,
I support this.
I support this as well. All right.
So to close out our A block here, so back in all the way back, about a year ago, actually a year ago to today.
Today. Yep.
Today, at the age of 46, we lost the lead singer to the band The Cranberries, Dolores O'Riordan. Steve, share some memories of Dolores.
Oh, yeah. This was a legit shock. I mean, she was only 46 years old.
That's my age right now.
Yeah, and that's scary.
Yeah.
At least three of us are in that decade. Tim, you lucky bastard. And so, yeah, it was a
you're only shock. As old as you feel.
All right. So how old do you feel there, Tim?
About 7.
Okay, that's perfect. I'm 21. Front woman of the Cranberries. Very influential band in that it came out. They came out, during the grunge time, but they had nice crossover appeal that was both pop and rock and a little bit grungy too. Especially that their second band, I was going to make a terrible pun, but I'm going to hold off on it.
Do it.
Okay, like their songs, Dreams and Linger, kind of linger on in the pop music, in pop music these days. So you can still hear those, but I kind of preferred more of the second album with Zombie and Salvation, which were like really hard, rocky, gungy songs. But one of the things I really liked about her voice in particular is she's from Ireland, and she was one of the few, and still is, one of the few singers who didn't try to, like, Americanize her voice for radio to kind of have more appeal. Something a lot of actresses and actors do as well. You can hear that Irish accent in some of her songs, and it's beautiful. She had an incredible voice. And I didn't know this until later on and really start to understand what the lyrics of songs mean. Politically in her own country, she was very, very much stood out politically, with, the wars in Ireland, between the IRA and, with England, and just not
with their bombs and their
with
guns.
Their bombs and their guns and their bombs. Yeah. And yeah. They were told several times not to release a song like Zombie. And she's like, fuck it, we're releasing it as our single anyway. One of the best comments I heard or read when I was doing a lot of research going back in old Rolling Stones and stuff like that from their time in like Spin Magazine and stuff from when they were around, and then also after she passed, U2 put out a statement, and she said she had such strength of conviction, yet she could speak to the fragility in all of us. She also had a very troubled history. She had a very traumatic childhood. Had problems with alcoholism and bipolar disorder, but she was actually in good health when she passed. She ended up drowning after passing out being drunk. And obviously, that's not the best of health, but it was a complete accident.
Mm-hmm.
They were actually going on tour starting in March of last year, or maybe it was March of this year, but they were planning a tour to go around, and just an absolute shock. Her bandmates were shocked. Very sad. Still had a couple solo albums that were put out a few years before that really didn't make it anywhere. But band I never saw, and I really would have liked to see them as they come around. Not that my entertainment really matters in someone's death, but.
Yeah, I mean, for me, her voice, that's college for me. I just think back, between all, Stone Temple Pilots, Soundgarden, Nirvana, Pearl Jam, all those bands, the Cranberries were right there, and you heard all those songs, and also, it was like, also just makes you think of Ireland, because they were using one of their songs for the tourism commercials for a long time.
Yeah, and this might be controversial, but kind of more Irish than U2 itself.
Yeah.
I obviously, you two, some of their older songs go back to Ireland. Their old songs go back to Ireland, but I would associate them more, Dolores, more with the Irish than I would like Bono. And it goes back to that kind of Americanization of U2 and their music as opposed to the Cranberries. The Cranberries are actually going to be, this literally came out today, they're going to be releasing a new song tomorrow.
Really?
So on January 15th, if you're hearing this, there's going to be a new song with Dolores O'Riordan's vocals that they were working on, because they were working on a new album. And they decided to, for her anniversary of her passing, which will be the 15th, tomorrow as we're recording this, we'll have a new song out.
Nice. So look forward to seeing, catching on iTunes. Tim, what about you? Cranberries fan?
I admittedly am not familiar with their discography beyond sort of the singles like Linger, and Zombie is a banger of a song.
Yeah.
I mean, that's really spectacular. You know, anytime you get one of those, you see one of those advertisements for like a 90s compilation, you know, grunge buzz thing, feel the buzz, you know, whatever, like it's always going to be on something like that. It's just very, very iconic in its way. And I think some people think of them as a one-hit wonder, and they're really not.
No,
actually.
They're not, yeah.
No.
And that, you know, hopefully that myth can be dispelled if, you know, anything, again, entertainment-wise comes out of a person's death. Perhaps people will gain a better appreciation for what they brought and are still bringing, evidently.
Yeah, I just went on Google and that popped up. They might be coming out with a whole album.
Oh, okay.
Not just one song.
Look forward to hearing it. Scott, what about your thoughts on Dolores?
Well, I when the Cranberries kind of broke out, I was actually in college and working at my college radio station, and we played the crap out of Everybody Else Is Doing It, So I Can't Wait. And you know, Steve, actually, as much as I love Linger, you know my favorite song is on that album?
Is it Sunday? Dreams or?
Oh, Sunday.
Wow, deeper cut.
I like Sunday. My radio station, we used to play the deep stuff. We didn't play, although I used to play the crap out of Lenny Kravitz, but that was in my drunken years. We didn't play Linger, because you could hear Linger anywhere.
Yeah, yeah.
We used to play the deep stuff. We played Dreams. We played Sunday off that album. When No Need to Argue came out, we used to play, we didn't play Zombie. We played Ridiculous Thoughts, Dreaming My Dreams. That's the stuff we played on our station.
Yeah,
because you could listen to Zombie anywhere.
That's a lost art.
Yeah. So I won't say I was the biggest Cranberries fan, but I was fascinated by their stuff, and I liked her voice. Mm-hmm. Very unique.
Beautiful.
Yeah, gorgeous voice for that time. I love listening to Irish – well, except for Sinead. I like listening to Irish and Scottish singers. I like the mix of voice. And I'll tell you something. I feel like she – it's funny that you mentioned, Steve, about the whole – she identifies with Ireland more than U2 does, because she seemed very Irish to me. Whereas Bono – well, he's Bono. You know what I mean? Like, Bono isn't anything but Bono. You know what I mean? Yeah. Dolores O'Riordan was Irish, and she had that identity that I feel like the bigger U2 got, the less that identity was. But I mean, it's U2. They're one of those iconic supergroups. But the first two albums I remember very, very well, and we played a lot of the deep stuff. So I got a good appreciation for them from those first two albums, because we played the deep stuff. We used to get yelled at. Somebody played Linger and got yelled at. Our PD yelled at the kid. He was like a sophomore, poor bastard. He got yelled at because in fact, they put a line through the, oh my God, through the CD, put a marker through it. No Linger, no Zombie, everything else. So I had a great, because we can listen to those anywhere. Commercial stations are playing that. We were non-commercial. So I gained a great respect for her and her writing from those two albums, because we got to play like the other stuff. So I highly recommend the song Sunday. and on the second album. What do you think, Steve? Ridiculous Thoughts? That's a good cut.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, Dreaming My Dreams. Those are two songs I like. So, yeah. Now, she had an amazing voice, and it was great being in college radio in the early 90s to be able to listen to stuff you couldn't hear anywhere else. So,
yeah, what a great time for music, just period.
Oh, yeah.
I agree 100%.
To be able to explore some of that.
Yeah, I was DJing, actually, back then, and sometimes I work in rock and roll bars. Unfortunately, the only Cranberry song I really would play was Salvation, because it had a higher beat to it.
Oh, yeah. Another great song, yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, that's going to bring us to the close of our A block. So, you know, we're halfway there, guys. We have a lot of other people to talk about coming up after the break. So, everybody out there, stick around. It's Scott Criscolo, Steve Willey, and Tim Capel hanging out here with me, Andy Atherton, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place Beat Nation's Justin Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceBeatNation.com. And we now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place Beat Nation Wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, Main Event, Survey Says, Wrestling War Zone, a Monday Night Wars podcast retrospective, No Holds Barred, Jeff Learns Wrestling, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows. On top of that, we're also dipping into the vault, re-releasing the entire catalog of Where the Big Boys Play for your enjoyment. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver special network pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation pop feed is loaded with great content, offering such tremendous shows covering the land of pop culture, such as Geek and Sassy, Talkin' Pop, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Sunday Groove, PTB in Play, Freak Out Drive-In, Songs with Friends, Looking Forward, Looking Back, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Conversation Comics, DC Post Crisis Management, Marvel Age, and Marvel Age Masterclass, plus weekly pod blasts that cover the gamut of comic topics. The feed is also filled with insightful sports content, including the NBA team, This Week in the NFL, and more.
And you can find all these current shows, plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well, by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available at PlayStation.com. We cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, in-depth stretch projects, and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlayStation.com/Amazon while doing your online shopping, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlayStation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Nation, welcome back to our special In Memoriam 2018 show here on the Place to Be Nation Pop Feed. I'm Andy Atherton, along with Scott Criscolo, Steve Willey, and Tim Capel.
So we're going to move on with our memorializing here. But first, we just want to mention some things. Go to placemination.com. Lots of great articles, lots of great podcasts featuring all the gentlemen that have joined me today. We'll be plugging future shows at the end of tonight's program. Also, make sure you visit our Pro Boards at bigelow34.proboards.com. All kinds of great subjects, topics to discuss over there. We have the year that was, 1996. Is that correct, Scott?
Yes, it is. We're listing the matches now. I think we're still in January. Mm-hmm. So take a look at the list and start watching and voting.
And Scott, you put something up every day over there to talk about?
I do. I do a viewing. Okay. Whatever I'm, you know, in the mornings at work, things are a little quiet. So certain days when I'm my days don't really pick up, I'll throw on the network and pick something. Usually it's either like an 82 Mid-Atlantic or a 98 Raw I'm watching. And I'll just put my viewing up and maybe start a discussion. If you're bored, throw it on. And, you know, just kind of something to get some fun discussion going, something random that I watch. So check that out. And, of course, also the question of the day.
Your PIC.
Which usually be anything. Could be wrestling or other. So you can check that out as well. A lot of great stuff. Bigelow34.proboards.com. A lot of JRs and my old reviews are on there, written reviews. A lot of good stuff. So check it out.
Yeah, and also for one of my other shows, The Great Debate, I have a Facebook page. That's the Police Nation's Great Debate on Facebook. And every day there are two polls up now. In the morning I do a pop culture or sports or whatever. Could be food, could be music, could be movie related. And then based on my appearance on the main event with The Great Debate, I put up all the wrestling questions. These are all rapid fire rounds. There's lots of this or that. And people seem to like it, so every night now there'll be a wrestling question. So tonight are two belts suggested by one of the panels, Mr. Criscolo.
So, it's a belt. Who else would it be? Who else would have recommended?
Yes, the resident belt junkie of Place to Be Nation. So every day, yeah, we have at least two polls up. And just, yeah, go in there, take a minute, vote, and, you know, just have a little fun. So speaking of fun, we lost somebody at the ripe age of 95, and it still hit a lot of people hard on November 12th of this past year. He was the, you know, the creator of many, many superheroes, comic book characters, quite a character himself. The great Stan Lee passed away. Tim, as one of our resident comic experts here at Place to Be Nation, why don't you give a few words? I know you guys over there, you know, Nick, Greg, Todd, Russell, yourself, have probably all talked a lot about Stan, but, you know, give us a few words for tonight's show.
Yeah, so if you want to hear a more in-depth discussion about Stan Lee and his legacy, check out Plug Alert coming here. The Marvel Age Masterclass, companion podcast to the Marvel Age podcast, is hosted by Ben Morse, and he and Nick Duke had the chance to get together. It may have even been the day of Stan Lee's passing to record an episode of Marvel Age Masterclass. I think that was the most recent installment of that show. So go check it. Go track it down if you want to hear more, a more in-depth and dedicated discussion about Mr. Stan Lee. I will add to that, you know, I would not be the person I am today if not for the influence and the contributions of Stan Lee. I got into comics at a really early age. I've told this story a few times, but basically I don't remember a time in my life when I was not interested in comics, particularly Marvel comics. And I learned to read as early as I did, mainly because I wanted to be able to read my expanding comics collection. And while I was not necessarily reading the words on the page of Stan Lee at the time, all of that can be traced back to his influence and his co-creations, I will say. I do stress co-creations because, you know, it did not take long at all. You know, following the news of his passing, lot of people coming out and a lot of discussion around the controversy over what Stan personally created and did, and how much of that really belongs to him solely, how much of that credit he shares with his artist, and whether he should really get credit at all, which is sort of a radical position to take, but it's out there. On that note, I think I'll leave it at, you know, there were not meticulous records of these things kept back then. We're talking the early 60s. This was work for hire. No one up to that point had ever made their millions, if they'd even made millions, working in comics. And in fact, many creators dating back to the golden age of comics were in fact destitute by then. So it wasn't a huge matter of priority keeping track of who did what, you know, down to the letter. And to me, I just think that even if you are one to say, well, Stan Lee himself never created anything, you know, he didn't, it was all just, you know, a PR job. He was glad handing, he stole credit from his artists, and all he really did was put words on the page, fill in the word balloons. Even if you want to take that position, that's still not nothing. Stan Lee's scripts, even if, again, that's what you want to limit his contributions to, count for a lot. Look at things like his early X-Men work, really the entirety of his X-Men work, which he was not on that series a long time. Look at Spider-Man with and without co-creator Steve Ditko, which I think the influence of Ditko, the artist on that series, is a lot more pronounced than other Marvel publications. Look at Stan Lee's Silver Surfer, which I feel like throughout our coverage on Marvel Age is quintessentially Stan Lee. He definitely had a voice. He had a message to impart. And you can't just say, well, the story was really all driven by the artist and Stan Lee was just kind of this puppeteer. I just think that's sort of an overcorrection of history. And the fact of the matter is Stan Lee and his artists, kind of that foundation of what we think of today as Marvel Comics, they were just rocket fuel. And you couldn't have one without the other, because that is what differentiated the company, allowed them to stand out and enjoy their success. To kind of quote Greg Phillips, who I had a conversation on this very topic with off air in the days after Stan Lee's passing, if this was just, you know, Gardner Fox from DC's Justice League on scripting duty for early Marvel comics, you would not have come away with the same thing. Not by any means. As great as and as groundbreaking as the art on things like Fantastic Four from Jack Kirby were, and Steve Ditko's Spider-Man, you really needed something else to have it a cut above everything else. And I think that's where Stan Lee came in. And I think that's sort of what he needs to be remembered for in terms of his creative efforts. In terms of him as a person, I'll just leave it at this. Stan Lee always seemed like he was having fun. No matter what he did in any interview, any public appearance he made, just seemed like it was where he wanted to be and was having a blast. So, and I think there's a lot to be said for that. I've probably spoken too much for what should have been a fairly brief commemoration. So I'll hand it over to you guys.
All right. Thanks, Tim. Well said. I'm going to quickly plug a previous show as well. On the last episode of Looking Forward, Looking Back, number two, I was joined by Jennifer Smith and both Hard Traveling Fanboys, Nick Duke and Greg Phillips. And we did speak about the death of Stan Lee. So I'll briefly just mention, you know, like I've said, I'm not a comic reader, although I may start. But, I mean, I'm a fan of the characters in the movies. I point to his hysterical appearance in the movie Mallrats.
Oh, I was just going to talk about that.
Yeah. Yes, well, I'll let you go into it. But, yeah, my favorite line, though, was Brody, Jason Lee, says to him, so, like, the thing, was this dork, like, made of orange rock like the rest of them? We didn't really cover that stuff. And then I mentioned that on the other show, and Nick goes, I could say that it is, yes. But, yeah, and then it just became a thing. Like, my kids, it was like a game with my kids who I take to all the Marvel movies to find the Stan Lee cameo. I usually get, like, hit on the arm. Like, Dad, there's Stan Lee, there's Stan Lee. And it was always, like, a fun cameo. He's always, like, always got to deliver a funny line or be in a funny situation. You know, get drunk with Thor in the Avengers Age of Ultron, or, you know, be an angry bus driver, or you know, a DJ in a strip club in Deadpool. So the man knew how to have fun. So Steve, so you can talk about Mallrats and whatever else you might like to talk about the great Stan Lee.
Well, it's hard to go into much more than Tim already did. And I'm saying that as a compliment, Tim, not as a criticism. He was kind of larger than life, and without him, even if like someone like Steve Ditko invented every single character and did all the work, I don't think that I think that without Stan Lee, it wouldn't have been told. People wouldn't have discovered it. An incredible promoter. You know, his kind of cheesy dialogue was very endearing, I think, to, you know, people of, you know, Tim and I, my age, who got into comic books. Like, it lasted for years and years and years, like, the, you know, all the alliteration and it very well
identifiable. Well, and it rubs off on you too.
Oh yeah. I really liked the book I was looking it up as we were talking, Marvel Comics: The Untold Story. Just a phenomenal book, and really helped me understand a little bit more about what was going on that time, and how long it took for Steve and Stan to get back together, and really how sad it was that, you know, they couldn't. I mean, Stan did, but like so many of the people who created these iconic characters really didn't cash in as well as they should. Spider-Man is where it is at for me. You know, even to this day, it's still where it's at. I started reading comic books probably when I was 6 or 7 years old. I had a friend give me some sort of collector set for a birthday, and I know my dad had a friend that he worked with who let me borrow like a box of comics that I probably had no reason to have. You know, we're talking like super old 60s Spider-Man, like, you know, the early first 20 issues that I was reading as like an 8-year-old. Yeah, like millions of dollars worth of books, I'm sure now. It's the thing with Mallrats, with all of his movies, like that's the iconic Stan Lee movie scene to me. Not the Marvel appearances and when is he gonna pop up in, you know, the new Spider-Man cartoon? When is he gonna pop up in Thor Ragnarok? He had an extended scene in that movie where it was this crazy, ridiculous Kevin Smith movie with stink palming people and fearing and respecting the escalators. And here comes Stan Lee to talk about romance when Brody is, you know, trying to figure out what the thing's cock looks like. just underrated Kevin Smith movie, by the way.
Well, actually, probably my favorite Kevin Smith movie.
Yeah, and a guy still amazingly how much he traveled around in his 90s. Mm-hmm. We have a huge air show that's south of me that draws a lot of celebrities, and every year he would show up and kind of Hush Hush show up. Even as I don't think 2018, but as late as 2017, he came and kind of did a under the radar signing. I don't even think you had to pay for it. It was just kind of a real hush hush thing that we found out, that my friend found about the day that it happened, who owns a comic book shop. So like he, you know, kind of rushed over there. It's just crazy that someone at that age would still do that kind of work and still be so excited to meet up with fans and to talk comic books. And like you said, Tim, just genuinely seems like he's having a good time and is living his best life.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, I kind of felt like, and sorry not to step on Scott or Andy or anyone. I sort of felt like when we started the Marvel Age podcast that this day would come. Like it was just sort of inevitable that we'd have to have this conversation. Now, I did not expect that along the way we would also kill Steve Ditko and Marie Severin and then Stan Lee. I'm sure if Jack Kirby was still with us, we would have taken him out too. So I don't want to call it the curse of the Marvel Age podcast, but wow. Let's just say I'm glad that we've become more familiar with the works of Stan Lee and the foundational creators of the Marvel Universe in doing that podcast. And, you know, it's allowed us to kind of have something a little bit more meaningful, I think, to say in the wake of their passing.
Yeah. Scott, I'll hand it over to you in 1 second. For me, also, Stan Lee is like in like a very elite group of people in my head. I like to call them creators of the universe. So you got your like your George Lucas, your Gene Roddenberry, your J.K. Rowling, your J.R.R. Sure. Tolkien, yeah. George R.R. Martin. Like they created this whole world. You know, people that inhabited a vernacular, like the whole thing, like laws of physics and whatever, and all these other things. And that to me, that's just astounding. Like that people can do that. Like, just incredible. So, Scott, why don't you talk about Stan Lee?
I won't go long. These guys echoed it. He's the voice. He was the print of a generation. I was very diplomatic. I've always been diplomatic in my comic reading. I love DC. I love Marvel. A little bit of both. When I was a kid, I was a gigantic Spider-Man fan. I also love the Hulk. The Hulk was probably my favorite as a kid. I've always been a Hulk fan. And, you know, DC didn't have that recognizable guy. You know, there wasn't a face of DC. There was. The face of DC was Superman. He was the face of DC. And then, of course, eventually probably replacing him, I would think, would be Batman. But I guess that depends on your point of view. Marvel, the face of Marvel was Stan Lee. And I think Kirby and Ditko got the credit. I think there was a lot of credit that went around. And you know, I have a ton of stuff on my shelves here. I've got, I'm very lucky to have a region free DVD player, and I actually have three, region two. So they came from England, the old 60s Marvel, animated shows. I have Iron Man. There were four of them at the time. There was Iron Man, Thor, Submariner, and Cap. I have Thor, Iron Man, and Cap because Submariner right now it's like fucking $110 or something. Like screw that. But these three were a little more affordable.
Yeah.
But it reminds me of how the awesome stuff of Marvel in the 60s and 70s and you know and you don't discount Super Friends and the stuff and the DC stuff. But Stan was just a marketing genius. And he kept, when Marvel's was struggling in the, well, I guess the 90s, I suppose, he was able to kind of help them get out of it. And now, look, they have, they're an empire. And DC has an empire too in their own way. But Stan Lee has a face that DC never had. And he'll always be remembered for that. whether it was on the, you know, the cameos in the MCU movies. I actually have a DVD. I think it came with my Spider-Man, the first Sam Raimi one, whenever I bought that DVD fucking 16 years ago, I guess. it's an interview with it because it came out in 2002. It's him and Kevin Smith at some comic store in Santa Monica. And it's just the two of them shooting the shit. It's really good. If you can find it.
I don't know what you're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah, it's awesome. It definitely came with my first Spider-Man. Tremendous. So rest in peace, Stan. You've earned it. You've earned the chance to rest in heaven right now because you worked every minute of the 95 years of your life. And look, you put a word in the dictionary. I guarantee you Excelsior is in the dictionary somewhere. Rest in peace, Stan.
All right. Well, sticking with you, Scott, actually back in August on the 25th at the age of 81, Senator John McCain passed away. So why don't you give us some thoughts on John McCain?
John McCain is a lot, you know, he was kind of his death for the Republicans. I mean, he was globally loved, I would think, in some circles because he was a line crosser like crazy. But if we're going specific parties, he was to the Republicans what Ted Kennedy was to the Democrats. He was the lion of the Senate. He was the face of their side for many, many years. And he, he was a POW. And I actually read his book. And it was not pretty. I'll tell you that right now. He was a straight shooter. He didn't mess around. He didn't care whether you were wearing an R, a D, an I, it didn't matter what letter you wore. He told you what he felt. He told you what he believed, and he stuck by it. And he gave Bush a run for his money in both the 2000 and 2004 primaries. With a better campaign, he maybe had a shot to beat Obama in 2008, maybe. But his marketing, his campaign team was a bunch of numbnuts. Mm-hmm. They ran like the shittiest campaign I've ever seen in my life, but which was mimicked by fucking Mitt in 2012. But it was the same idiots. But John McCain was an incredible man who stuck to his guns and protected the people of Arizona. I always remember, like, in his press conferences, people always were like, why is he hold his arms so odd? Like, why is his, like, his arms are like only half up? I'm like, cause he broke both of them and they weren't by accident. So, he's a hero and he's also buried at Arlington. And, again, he was the face of the Senate along with Ted Kennedy for many, many, many years. And, he'll be missed very much so. Guys like that, you're not going to see, regardless of party. Guys like that, you're not going to see anymore. Guys who cross lines and solve problems. I guarantee you, if McCain or Ted were alive, the government would be open right now. That's for sure.
Oh, yeah.
Just like the Bushes, he was a true patriot. He was a soldier. And he'll be missed. He'll be missed.
All right, Steve, how about you?
I'm going to start with my big disappointment about John McCain. I wish, and it's a compliment, really. I wish John McCain would have been John McCain when he ran for president. Because, like you said, Scott, like, whatever his campaign team did to him, he just wasn't the same guy with that. Like, he was, before he ran for president, he was the longest, he had the most guest appearances on Jon Stewart's show than anybody else.
Yep. Yeah, you're right.
Was willing to laugh at himself, was, you know, willing to, you know, Jon Stewart, fairly liberal guy, but, you know, also Jewish. And, you know, so they had that, you know, they could have those kind of arguments and discussions and laugh about him. And as soon as he started running for president, it's like he became a different man. And once that ended, it's like you could start seeing that. You know, I'm John McCain. I'm going to do what I think is right or wrong. And obviously, an incredible war hero. For someone to go through what he had to go through in Vietnam, and I didn't read his book because I just can't stomach that kind of stuff, but you know, I know enough. Mm-hmm. It's just incredible, and there are fewer and fewer politicians that are willing to do that kind of sacrifice for their country. Again, another guy I don't agree with anything. You know, not I think I don't agree with everything that he's done. However, incredible respect for the man, what he has done for our country, and kind of had his big finale when he came into the Senate and basically said, we're not undoing this health care bill. We're going to fix it instead of destroy it. It was like this one last moment that he had.
All right. Tim.
Yeah, I will largely echo that. In John McCain's passing, he's sort of that last of the old guard who was someone you could think of as a true statesman. And while I think he was quite disillusioned after, you know, the 08 campaign, when he was diagnosed with his brain tumor, far from going quietly into that good night, he stood in defiance of that diagnosis and, you know, all practical good sense, potentially by rediscovering sort of his the way that he would vote with his conscience and not necessarily toe the party line. Talk about how he was the maverick, and we sort of got to see that again in his final days. So yeah, he did not go down without a fight, for sure. And yeah, it is similar to Bush 41 in a lot of respects. So it's almost see my comments there. And yeah, you really don't find in our, you know, political field right now, anyone like that from either party.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a truly a great man. I mean, you know, I agree with everything Scott had to say about his campaign against Obama. I have a friend of mine who follows politics a lot more closely than I do, which I don't. He basically said McCain needed a war. Like, if we were at war, on the brink of war or something, you know, being a former military man, you know, might have helped him. I don't know if I agree with that, but, you know, that's the kind of statement I can add to there. I don't really follow politics, you know, kind of like Tim in sports, I guess.
He was a warist, like baseballist.
So now we lost on April 21st at the age of 49. Unfortunately, according to my research, another suicide. Vern Troyer, best known as Mini-Me from the Austin Power second and third movies. You know, you look at, you know, the most famous or well-known little people actors, if you will. There's Billy Barty, you know, Tony Cox, Kenny Baker, Warwick Davis, and Peter Dinklage, and Vern Troyer is up there also because he appeared in so many things.
Forgot somebody.
Who'd I forget, Steve?
Puppet.
Oh.
Jesus, God, oh, you're so right, Steve. Billy Barty in a trash can? No way, man.
So
I thought you were going to say Andre, what's his name?
Or did they say Mickey from Seinfeld? But no, but he was, yeah, all of 2'8". So he was a really tiny fellow. But, he, you know, he was a guy that just ate up fame. He just loved being out there. He you know, he knew he was there to help everybody laugh. I mean, he knew, you know, he had worked in a lot of things. I don't know if you remember the first Harry Potter movie, but he was one of the what were the creatures at the bank? Goblins. He was the goblin that takes Hagrid and Harry down to the vault in the beginning at the first meeting there. Once they go to London, Harry and Hagrid, towards the beginning of the first book. So yeah, he he was quite the character. Did his own stunts because he couldn't have a stuntman who was his size. Was also in The Love Guru, which was a horrible movie. Bubble Boy, and he just appeared in so many things. Scott, Vern Troyer.
He was Mini-Me. He was awesome as Mini-Me. I know that he had struggled health-wise for most of his life. He had one of the more difficult little people diseases. I don't know how else to say it. And that's why he had – not only was he short, but his arm – he always – if you notice, his arms were kind of shaped unusually. And so he – I know that from what I'd read, he had been in a lot of pain in a lot of his life. So for a guy who did his own stunts, God bless him, because – I don't know if I could handle that kind of pain. So it was really sad because he probably could have lived like Billy Barty and been an actor till he was in his 60s, 70s. But unfortunately I think the pain was too much for him. It's really sad, but you know, the music video in prison will always be one of the coolest.
Yes, it's a hard knock.
They stole it from Annie and they're better at it. So,
all right, Steve.
And nothing much to say besides, you know, his performances in Austin Powers were part of what made that movie so beloved. And really, you know, you see Peter Dinklage was more of like the action drama little person of his generation. Well, Vern Troyer is the comedian of them.
Yeah. All right, Tim.
Yeah, you know, I understand he did live with a lot of pain, and I don't know. I hope that if there was more that could have been done for him, that it wasn't like a question of means. He was a big part of the pop culture landscape in those Austin Powers films. I have not revisited them in a long time. I don't know how they've aged necessarily, but it's the type of thing, like, even if that was all he did, it should have set him up for life. And I don't know whether or not that's the case, but I would hope so. Whatever the case, it's certainly a sad way to punctuate the end of his life. I don't know what else to say really, other than I hope he was well cared for.
Yeah, and it showed that Mini-Me didn't speak, so he had to convey everything almost like a mute. So, and it was hysterical, and you know, he pretty much held his own with Mike Myers in a lot of those scenes. Mm-hmm. And how he didn't, like, you know, break down a lot of times with some of that ridiculous crap that was going on in those movies. It's beyond me. I love that first time that fat bastard comes into the volcano lair in the Spy Who Shagged Me. And then the whole scene where he comes out and he takes the mojo and everything like that. And you're lucky, wee man. So, it's funny shit. So... Steve, so August 5th, at the age of 92, we lost Charlotte Ray.
Yeah, and Charlotte was more, for the most of her career, both before her most famous roles and after, is really a character actor. But when she came into her own was as what was originally supposed to be a character actor role on the show Different Strokes, and she played Edna Garrett, who... was a housekeeper for the Drummond family on Different Strokes. And she proved to be popular enough that, as we talked about with Laverne and Shirley, something that they did back in these days were spin off a character from a sitcom to their own show. And she became the head of the Facts of Life, where she played the house mother for a girls' boarding school. And, you know, really known, as we joked about in a chat the other day, recognizable for her red hair, and popular among several generations because both Different Strokes and Facts of Life are shows that still run in syndication to each, you know, to this day. And actually, the entire cast reunited in 2011 for Nickelodeon, and she took home a Pop Icon Award. At first, I thought it was the whole cast. Like, you got, you know, you got Tootie up there, and got Lisa up there, and you got Joe up there.
Yeah, Natalie,
and, you know, they George Clooney they got, because George Clooney got one of his big spots, first spots in, on Facts of Life, mm-hmm. little known fact. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, she was the one who took the Pop Icon Award home. It still was acting throughout the 2000s.
Wow.
Which was, you know, she was old back when she was on Facts of Life.
Greg Phillips does a killer Mrs. Garrett impersonation.
Yeah, it's probably just a female version of Jim Ross. There's not much different there.
It might actually, according to him, it's Katharine Hepburn, but I got his number.
Yeah, I remember her on Nick at Night when they would show the old Car 54, Where Are You? Episode. She played what the hell was Al Lewis's character's name? But they were hysterical. I mean, Grandpa Munster and Mrs. Yeah. Garrett as a married couple just arguing. It was Leo Schnauzer. That was the character's name. I don't remember what her character's name is off the top of my head, but yeah, there was some. You know, she's like, I tell him every day, he never listens to me. What do you tell him? Drop dead. He's like, keep cooking for me, I will. All right, Tim, Mrs. Garrett, the great Charlotte.
No, I think I said what I needed to say.
About Greg Phillips' impression.
Yeah, that's about it. Look, I really enjoyed the Facts of Life and reruns of USA up. What was it called? The thing that they did in the 90s, their little block of shows in the morning. And yeah, I just remember during being on summer break, that being like the first show I watched in the morning, whatever time I got up. And yeah, I think I've seen that whole series probably two times over at least, just by accident, really.
Scott.
Mrs. Garrett. Mrs. Garrett.
It's a little creepy there.
Charlotte Ray, again, kind of like Penny Marshall was kind of the face of that era in a lot of ways. I believe she was – I don't know if she had gone to the Facts of Life by the time Arnold and Dudley were playing in the bike shop. But maybe she was gone by then. And a lot of people forget, you know, we think of, you know, Joe and Blair and Tootie and Natalie, but the first season of The Facts of Life, there was like 37 girls in that house.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and including Molly Ringwald.
Including Molly Ringwald, correct.
I had a thing for Cindy when I was a kid.
Was she the one with the baseball hat?
Yeah, she was a tomboy.
Yeah. She obviously should have played baseball because she obviously sucked at acting. She didn't last very long.
But she came back on later.
She did, yeah. She was again the face of she was one of those television icons from the late 70s into the 80s, and she was kind of that like the one that could always trust. Like Mrs. Garrett had the face you could trust, and I think that's why they gave her the ability to go off and do her own show, because she could carry it, and she did. You know, and it didn't hurt that she had a good ensemble of actresses.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, no, she'll be missed. She was one of those trusted faces of television throughout the 80s, because the 80s were just loaded with one fucking amazing TV show after another, and sitcoms in particular. And she'll be missed. She'll be missed. Face of a generation.
Yeah. Yeah. Rest in peace, Mrs. Garrett. So we're going to give a few more honorable mentions before we move on. So John Mahoney the great actor, played
Papa Crane.
Martin Crane, that's right, on Frasier. Yeah. Also played Winona Ryder's boss in the movie Reality Bites. He was kind of a prick in that.
And she was, and he was Ione Skye's father in Say Anything, who ripped off the old folks' home.
Ah,
right.
Director.
He had a fantastic performance in a show called In Treatment that I watched. I might be the only person who watched it, unless Steve, you watched it.
Is that the HBO one?
Yeah, the HBO one with Gabriel Byrne. I kind of love that show.
I don't know if I saw that season. I would have known if I did.
He was in the not the last one they did, because they only did three. He would have been in the second.
Oh, okay, I saw some of that one. Yep.
Yeah. I mean, something that went completely overlooked because no one knew what the hell that show was and no one was watching it. But
yeah, it was like 43 episodes or 45 episodes or something, and it was 9 weeks long, 5 days a week.
Right, of people's therapy sessions.
Mm-hmm.
Fictionalized, scripted therapy sessions. Not to all tastes. So, yeah, incredible in that. And, yeah, that's it for John Mahoney.
Okay. Bernardo Bertolucci, the director of Last Emperor and The Last Tango in Paris, which we spoke about on the first episode of Year in Pop, 1972. Steven Hillenburg, the creator of SpongeBob SquarePants, at the age of 59 of ALS. Very sad. The actor-magician Ricky Jay, who was in a movie with somebody we're going to talk about a little later in the show. For those who watched Hee Haw as a kid, Roy Clark passed away this year also. Paul Allen, the co-founder of Microsoft. For those of you who watch the History Channel, Richard, the old man Harrison from the show Pawn Stars, died. The owner of the Houston Texans, Bob McNair, also passed away. And Kofi Annan, the former Secretary of Council of the United Nations. Mm-hmm. Tab Hunter, best known for Damn Yankee, $6 Million Man, Grease 2, basically a 50s heartthrob. The patriarch of the Jackson family, Joe Jackson, passed away. Probably somebody who made probably one of the biggest catches in Super Bowl history, the great Dwight Clark. Scott, you have anything to say about Dwight?
NFC Championship, not.
Oh, sorry, NFC Championship.
Thank NFC you. Championship, because it was against my Cowboys. That's why. Yeah. It was. It began a dynasty.
Mm-hmm.
It began a dynasty. It began a decade of decadence for the 49ers. And what's funny is a very quick story, because it's on the America's Game show about the 81 49ers. Dwight Clark wasn't even thought of to be on the Niners. He went to Clemson, and Bill Walsh wanted his quarterback at Clemson, whose name escapes me. The Niners were interested in him as, you know, to draft him, and they wanted Dwight Clark to come with him to run routes for him. And he runs the routes, and it turns out that, you know, Bill Walsh looked at him and said, "Wow, this guy's a pretty good receiver," and he ended up winning two rings. So,
oh, wow.
And of course, again, he made the great catch in the 81 NFC Championship against the Cowboys, and led to the dynasty. So, and he had ALS, so that. When you're a great athlete like that, and you get such a debilitating disease, it's sad. It's unfortunate, you know, to see something like that. But mm-hmm. Yes, rest in peace, Dwight.
And then the evangelist Billy Graham passed away this year, and also Ken Berry, the great character actor from F Troop and Mama's Family, amongst other. Mm-hmm. So, and we also back on August 16th, at the age of 76, we lost Aretha Franklin. One of the greatest singers of all time. Scott, talk about Aretha.
Well, as I did my Vince impersonation earlier, so I'll do it again. It's not as good as JR's, but it's Aretha Franklin from WrestleMania 3. But anyway, she was next to Diana Ross, she was probably the face of Motown in the 50s, 60s, through the 90s, I guess. She had an amazing voice. She didn't put up with any shit. She's fiercely defended the city of Detroit, even when it was in the toilet. And if you ask Jordan Duncan, it probably still is. and just one hit after another. I mean, you know, the average music fan probably doesn't realize she did more than Respect. That was a song, and that may be the song she's most remembered for. But she did a ton of great hits. All the way into the 80s. Freeway of Love. Who's Zoomin' Who? Zoomin' Who? There's a song, That's What I'm Gonna Do, which is a song you'll hear at some point on the show tonight. Mm-hmm. Which was in the top, I think it hit number in the top five in the Billboard charts in, I think, 74 or 75.
Her duet with George Michael.
Yes. Yep. She was an icon of Motown next to Diana Ross in terms of the face of Motown for the women. I mean, for the men, you think of, you know, Smokey Robinson, Marvin Gaye and Michael. But for the women, probably the two most recognizable faces of Motown were Diana Ross and Aretha. And then I think she went to Atlantic, I think, too. Yeah, I mean, just a voice of a generation. Silky smooth soul, great R&B. She cornered the market on it. So, sad loss for music.
Yeah. Steve, what do you say about the Queen?
I mean, that's it. The Queen of Soul. Mm-hmm. When Aretha died, I went into her discography, and this, you know, relating to what you said, Scott, and you can just go down that list and, you know, keep finding more and more songs that you didn't even realize she sang. Like, her deep cuts are hits.
Yep.
So, like, just an incredibly prolific lady who's, like, really lasted longer performing than she really should have. She was, you know, not healthy her entire life and still just performed for literally decades. Just absolutely iconic. Really created that Motown sound that just blew up in the late 70s, early 80s, and became mainstream for the first time.
Yeah. Yeah, Steve, I mean, sorry, Tim. What do you have to
add? Yeah. Yeah. Out of this world, Motownist. And I've been meaning to stop by her funeral, which I understand should be wrapping up any day now.
Sounds like Muhammad Ali's.
But I'm hoping I'll still have time. But yeah, I mean, an icon. What more can you say? I can't add to that at all.
Yeah, just a voice that's going to live on, you know, in terms of, you know, her music should always be played. You know, it's just incredible. Steve, back on March 14th at the age of 76, we lost Stephen Hawking. Why don't you talk about the great...
Yeah, this is a little known fact. Like, Tim and Scott, I don't even know if you know this, but I actually have a degree in science and I have a minor in physics and chemistry. Yeah, so little known Steve fact. So Stephen Hawking is a physicist, a cosmologist, very well known for, ironically, more of his paralysis and his voice than anything, but one of the great scientific geniuses of the late 20th and early 21st century. No, and I'm not going to get too nerdy on you guys, but kind of brought Einstein's relativity and the 20th century quantum mechanics together to help describe the universe. One of many people to do that. But I would say in terms of what the biggest thing he did as a scientist was to write it in a way that the public can understand it. So his big book was A Brief History of Time, which I believe came out in the 80s. And then in 2001, he wrote, I have this somewhere, The Universe in a Nutshell, and A Briefer History of Time, which kind of expanded on it and talked about the latest you know, updates, because that kind of field changes very quickly. So there really In my lifetime, there Neil deGrasse Tyson and Stephen Hawking are pretty much the only people that were able to reach the masses with, you know, how, in layman's terms, how we can understand the universe in a greater way. A little fun fact also, not about me, but about Stephen Hawking, his voice actually copyrighted. It is trademarked. So he showed up in some, he showed up on The Simpsons, I think Futurama. They had a role in The Big Bang Theory. So we kind of went into the, you know, into pop culture more than what scientists usually do. And that was more because of his disability. He had Lou Gehrig's disease. And surprisingly, he was diagnosed in 63 and lived with ALS for 55 years. I've met people who, I mean, when you think of Lou Gehrig, you know, that he didn't last that long after he was diagnosed. There are many people who can only make it a year or two, but made it through 55 years of suffering through a very painful disease and left him paralyzed for decades. So really not just amazing his genius, but what he was able to accomplish despite a very severe disability.
Yeah, I would direct people to the biopic, The Theory of Everything, that came out a few years ago.
Yes.
Which was a great movie, actually. What a love the he had with his wife. Mm-hmm. One of those that sustained, you know, no matter what obstacles were put in front of it. Tim, what do you say about Stephen Hawking?
Yeah, one of those, I mean, you don't think of physicists as having this public persona that becomes somewhat larger than life in the way that he did. I mean, yeah, you've got Neil deGrasse Tyson as kind of the, I guess, modern equivalent of that. But, yeah, I don't know of many people who couldn't tell you, even if they can't identify Stephen Hawking by name, you know who Stephen Hawking is, right?
Yeah.
That's just kind of universal now. And yeah, Steve, to your point, the way that he could write about science and these very almost esoteric concepts that are sort of seemingly impossible for a layman to wrap their head around, to present that in a way that it makes sense and is credible. And it's something that, I mean, certainly he's a great loss, just, you know, in his passing, but this is a skill that's kind of become lost too. And it's something that's so, so valuable in the way that, I mean, we don't look at science, I think, the way that we have historically, in that, you know, it gets politicized. There's controversy around just basic, you know, scientific facts and the scientific method. And he had that credibility to him and the way that he could, you know, present these things. So that's going to be the longer lasting loss, I think, and not having Stephen Hawking with us anymore.
Hmm. All right. Scott.
I'll be very brief. I believe it or not, and I didn't realize this until he died, and I'm embarrassed to say this, but I didn't even know he was British. I thought he was American. So I had no idea he was British. So because you have to remember, by the time our generation came around, he didn't speak. So right. And his voice doesn't sound British. So it never occurred to me, but a fascinating guy who really most of the time went over my head. I'm not going to lie, which means we know Steve is which we know Steve is already smarter than me. So I certainly know Stephen Hawking smarter than me too.
It's way beyond my level of comprehension.
But I didn't agree with everything, I particularly when it pertained to religion. But for the most part, I respected his opinions on science. And that's why I think it's because I'm a huge sci-fi fan. I've always respected him and his ability to let us think outside the box when it came to things like that, the universe. And, you know, I was a big fan of the original. I know Neil deGrasse Tyson kind of, I don't want to say remade, but he kind of did another edition of Cosmos. I remember the original Cosmos that Carl Sagan did. And again, that, I think that's what made me the sci-fi fan that I am now. But Stephen Hawking was one of those guys who you were kind of afraid to want to read about, or because you're like, you don't want to, you know, humiliate yourself as a moron, he's another part of pop culture. He's no, I mean, I know this may sound utterly silly, but he's no less important than Charlotte Ray or Penny Marshall in terms of what he meant to pop culture in the last 30 years. He was on The Simpsons. He was on Star. I'm looking at my box set now. He was on an episode of Star Trek: The Next Generation, or he was referred to. I know Gene Roddenberry was a big Stephen Hawking fan. So even if you didn't understand like the actual specifics of physics or anything like that, you can understand him being on shows like Star Trek, that he respected space, and we could all enjoy the thinking of what goes on beyond our atmosphere. And he'll be missed, because I like to think Neil deGrasse Tyson will, someone like him will continue to help educate, you know, continuing generations. And, you know, it's funny because I forgot who I was talking to about this, but with all the stuff, and this isn't a partisan problem, because many presidents have blown it off over the last 25 years. But it's amazing, since Columbia crashed, what's happened to NASA and our space program. It's like totally in the toilet, and that's a fucking shame. And hopefully, eventually, we go back to the stars again, and maybe Stephen Hawking was an inspiration for that. But we'll see. Hopefully we are. Hopefully it happens again. I'd love to see another space shuttle go up into space, or the space station. Or, you know, I'd like to be on Mars again, or we build on the moon. I know these sound goofy, but who would have thought? Like, when we were, like, you know, kids in 1982, we thought, Jesus, 35 years from now, we're going to be on the moon. Isn't that nuts? You know, and we're not. Yeah. But, you know, so maybe one day. Maybe one day. And he was the inspiration for it.
Mm-hmm. You know. Yeah. All right. So August 26th, at the age of 91, we lost one of the probably funniest playwrights of the last, you know, half century. Neil Simon passed away. Tim, why don't you talk about Neil Simon?
Okay. So Neil Simon is not Paul Simon. And going into this, I challenged myself. This is the Glenn Butler challenge. I told Steve this off air, so this is an exclusive, telling tales out of school, that I employed the Glenn Butler method of asking myself, can I name five things about Neil Simon? And I'm not sure I could at the time, but we'll see if I've since corrected that now. Neil Simon was a man. He died last year. Neil Simon was a playwright and a screenwriter as well. Neil Simon looked bore an uncanny resemblance, at least in 1974, the publicity photo I'm looking at, to Kevin Spacey, who I think we all wish had died instead last year.
Yeah.
But no, I'm not going to sit here and pretend that Neil Simon has had a tremendous impact on my own life. I know he's incredibly honored with more combined Oscar and Tony nominations than any other writer, and that is an incredibly big deal in his field. Certainly, I guess most popularly associated with The Odd Couple, the play that would give way to the sitcom of the 70s, which is maybe one of those, you know, watching it in reruns as a kid, maybe the earliest, oldest sitcom that I could watch and actually thought was funny and that I got. Because a lot of those old shows, especially when you're a kid, you try to watch them, you're sort of like, how did people find this funny? Like, you just don't really get it. And I did think that the, at least as of like the 90s or whenever this was, watching The Odd Couple, that it was still pretty endearing and funny. And, you know, could sit there and watch it like any other sitcom. But you know, beyond that, I can't say a lot about this man. He, again, I feel like I need to outsource this one a little bit because I'm not the right person to tell you about my great love for Neil Simon and his plays. I mean, looking over his body of work, I'm kind of like, yeah, there's The Odd Couple. Okay, heard of that, haven't seen it, heard of that. You know, it's just one of those so before my time types of deals. So I think I will go ahead and let you guys have your say now.
Well, I'm looking at IMDb. He has 101 writing credits, which is almost every one of his 30-plus plays have also been adapted into a motion picture, which is the greatest such achievement of any playwright or author, even surpassing William Shakespeare. I mean, wow. I just know, you know, things like, you know, like The Odd Couple, like, you know, stop leaving little notes on our pillow, on my pillow. We're out of cornflakes, F you. It took me 2 hours to figure out F you was Felix Unger. Gotta let that marinate.
Here you are. That's funny.
Gotta let that marinate for a minute. You know, stuff like Lost in Yonkers, Biloxi Blue is a lot. Basically, anything Matthew Broderick was a lead in for a little while. he wrote. Really funny, you know, we'll say kind of Borscht Belt type humor, I guess, from the time. You know, a lot of that Jewish
that's a comedy. Good way to put it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he just. Just the way, you know, in Murder by Death was also another really funny Neil Simon play. So as somebody who actually minored in theater for a little while, I did study a little bit of Neil Simon. But Scott, why don't you give your thoughts on Neil Simon?
My family was very much a TV family. We watched anything and everything, and you know, I'm the youngest of four. I had seven in my house, so we all had different. We all watched different things, and we adapted. And I could tell you that I probably, just because I had a mom and a sister, I think I've probably watched literally every movie that Neil Simon ever wrote. So I'm about to go blow my brains out. No, I'm only kidding. I mean, literally, almost every movie here, most of them anyway. Prisoner, Second Avenue. Goodbye Girl, Cheap Detective, California Suite, which has Jordan Duncan's favorite actor, Bill Cosby, in it. Chapter 2.
Starring in Cosby?
Bill Cosby. California Suite, Chapter 2. All these movies have Marsha Mason in them, too. Seems Like Old Times, which actually was a comedy with Chevy Chase and Goldie Hawn. Very funny. Only When I Laugh, another depressing Marsha Mason movie. Max Dugan Returns is actually very good. That's got... Jason Robards, that's actually a Matthew Broderick movie as well. He was a kid in that. That was actually came out before War Games, I think.
Oh.
Not the cage match. The Slugger's Wife, that's Rebecca De Mornay and what's his face? Why am I blanking? He played Danny Noonan in Caddyshack. Hello. Michael O'Keefe.
Mm-hmm.
Bright Beach Memoirs, speaking of.
Oh, yeah.
You're talking about Jewish, Andy. That was Jonathan Silverman.
Mm-hmm.
He plays a family in the 40, a kid who grew up in the 50s in Brighton Beach in Brooklyn, which was at the time predominantly Jewish. And so that had that kind of humor, but it was very, very funny.
Well, Brighton Beach Memoirs and Biloxi Blues, I think, are as close to autobiographical as you can get for him.
Yeah, exactly. So believe it or not, I watched a ton of, and I didn't even mention The Odd Couple. So I've watched a ton of Neil Simon movies as a kid. Only because, again, you know, when you have an older sister and a mother,
yeah,
you're screwed.
So I was going to ask you, Scott, if your sister was older, because I think that's why that we're struggling a little bit with it, is because it's just a little bit before all of our time. Like, right. It's our parents' generation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, like the 60s to the 80s for the most part. Right. And some TV that he wrote in the 50s, like Your Show of Shows. I know that show. But I was glad. I do – one of my favorite things that Neil Simon did, you know, was with Paul Simon when they did the classic CBS action show, Simon and Simon. That was a great detective show.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, no, I'm the youngest of my family. I have two older brothers and an older sister. And so Again, we were TV family. I highly recommend, actually. I wouldn't recommend any of the Marsha Mason stuff because I think you'd even for someone with a – even for a nice soul like Steve Willey, I don't think he could handle this Marsha Mason. But I do recommend Prisoner's Second Avenue. It took place – it was a New York play. The movie had Jack Lemmon and Anne Bancroft in it, and it's fucking hilarious. Highly recommend – it's that typical kind of sardonic New York – you would appreciate too, Andy, that sardonic New York humor that's kind of snarky, but – It's typical awesome Jack Lemmon. It's Jack Lemmon at his best, in his prime. Highly recommend it. I really recommend watching it. It's not dated or anything. It's hilarious, typical, funny, sardonic Neil Simon. California Suite was a good comedy. Seems like Old Times is like Chevy Chase before he would turn into an asshole. he was him and Goldie Hawn because they tried to capitalized on a movie they did called Foul Play, which wasn't Neil Simon, although it was very good. Anyway, I digress. I don't want to talk more Marsha Mason than I have to. But I know more of Neil Simon than a kid my age probably should. a tremendous talent. Tremendous talent. And yeah, anybody that could – it's not easy to – it's probably not easy to translate a screenplay into a movie. It's not. It bombs a lot of the time. But – Neil Simon just knew how to make people laugh, you know, and he wasn't a political guy. He wasn't one of those guys that was preachy or anything. He just wanted to make you giggle, yeah. You know, and I think that's lost now. Everybody has to have a point now instead of just being entertained. And that's what Neil Simon was good at. He was good at entertaining you. And again, a lot of great movies between like 75 and like 85, like that 10 years from 75 to 85. He had a ton of great movies that were screenplays.
Yeah,
he'll be missed.
I'm gonna sit down and watch the Cheap Detective soon.
I think Chevy Chase is in that one too. I think I might be wrong. That is. Oh no, it's Peter Falk.
Yeah.
Okay.
Probably Columbo.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
Yeah. All right, Steve. So, did you give a turn about Neil Simon?
No, I just kind of popped in with that. Okay. Yeah, there's really not much that Scott didn't already. Pretty much going through the entire filmography of Neil Simon, seeing everything, which is wow,
picking up the slack for sure.
Yeah.
more than I'm admitting.
Yeah,
I really wanted to, but that's what happens when you have an older sister who ruled the roost and you know had seniority over you for the TV.
Yeah. Well, and definitely, you know, growing up for you, like in, you know, northeastern United States, you know, near New York, you know, very much like if my grandma was on this podcast, first of all, that would have been awesome. And I'm thinking of doing a new show now.
I want to be on.
We're just going to give Steve Willey his own feed. His son has a show. His grandma's got a show.
Conscience.
Grandma Conscience.
Grandma Khan. But yeah, no, I mean, again, when you had older relatives.
Well, for me,
some of them I admit were good. Again, I highly recommend Prisoner Second Avenue because if anybody likes Jack Lemmon, he was a tremendous actor, and that's one of his funnier movies if you can appreciate good New York humor. But
yeah, well, growing up with my family from New York, from the Bronx, actually,
and there you go.
I'm actually I guess quarter Jewish. My grandmother was my dad's mom was Jewish. So, you know, I had a lot of relatives that were. So, like, watching that stuff, it was kind of like watching my family on TV. They kind of talked the same way. So, you know, like, it's all those things. Like, when you watched, like, Mel Brooks, when he was on Man About You as Uncle Phil, it was like a member of my family. He got arrested for using too many coupons. I highly suggest... I highly suggest seeking that out. You want to talk about devastated? Oh God, when Mel Brooks goes, I'm going to be devastated.
Oh man,
I do have a Mel Brooks story, but I'll save that for another show. When I almost met him, but all right. So we're going to move on to our final person tonight. So on September 6th, at the age of 82, we lost the great Burt Reynolds. Now, for me, you know, growing up as a kid. You know, some of the movies that I, you know, he was just cool. Let me just say that first. He was just the way he chewed gum, that mustache, everything, just the whole package. He was just, he had that laugh that, you know, and I watched, probably wasn't allowed to, but I remember watching Cannonball Run and Smokey and the Bandit. And he was just like, you wanted to be him. Then as I got older, you know, he started diving into a little bit more of his filmography. You know, he had Deliverance and Stroker Ace. And then he kind of went to TV for a little while with Evening Shade. You know, was also, you know, in the news a lot for his, or in the entertainment news, for his relationship with Lonnie Anderson. And then he kind of got a second lease on life in his career when he got cast in Boogie Nights as the great director Jack Horner. Of the pornography type. And then in one of my favorite roles of his, actually, as Congressman David Dilbeck in Striptease. He was just a sick bastard in that movie, and he was just hysterical. And, you know, I'm going to miss his work tremendously. I mean, just put those outtakes on from Cannonball Run with him and Dom DeLuise together. Oh, it just gold. if you could keep a straight face through all that, you're a better person than I am.
Gold.
Tim, you got any Burt Reynolds memories you want to share?
Not a whole lot. My exposure, probably my first exposure to Burt Reynolds, would have been during the Lonnie Anderson years. Mm-hmm. Although I will say that the same grandma who voted for Dukakis fucking loved Evening Shade. So
that was an old person show.
Yes, it was.
It really, yeah, yeah. And she would teach art classes out of her home, and would, like, the show was on at the same time she'd be doing this. And she would make a point to record Evening Shade so that she wouldn't miss it. And I just feel like every time I was over there, she's sitting in the den watching, catching up on Evening Shade. I'm just like, what the hell? Because, of course, I don't really get it. But it's just, I mean, the show wasn't even on that long. But it's just disproportionately memorable in my mind because of this. So, yeah. Yep.
Was she like my grandmother? Let me watch my program. my grandmother had Barnaby Jones and Rockford Files, and that was my grandmother's shows.
Yeah, I mean, there's just certain shows that it was like that. Mm-hmm. Well, I guess get her together with Steve's grandma. We'll have the grandma cast. And
there you go.
Yeah, that'll be...
I think when Evening Shade was on, the average age of a CBS viewer was like 65. Because that was in the Murder, She Wrote heyday.
75 now, yeah.
Something like that. Steve.
He actually won awards for that.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Won an Emmy, Golden Globe in 92.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep.
It's crazy.
Yeah, Steve, what else you got about Burt Reynolds over there?
I mean, his peak was like late 70s, early 80s, and it went downhill fast, but yet he was still working like crazy. Mm-hmm. Like if you go to his filmography, it is an entire separate page on Wikipedia because he was in so much stuff. And really, the same thing with Boogie Nights was, you know, not just Evening Shade. You know, that wasn't something we were going to watch, but Boogie Nights was just an absolutely incredible movie and got him more into the, like, critically acclaimed under 65-year-old crowd. He's always been around. Like, we all know of him. But outside of those classics, there wasn't... I mean, if you're looking at some of the stuff he did in the mid-80s and, you know, early 90s, it is dreck. And as of that, like, with his, you know, career going kind of down the tubes, like, I saw him the most in that downtime in that game show, Win, Lose, or Draw.
Oh, yeah.
That he started... And that's not even on his Wikipedia pages at all, but he started that show...
With Bert Convy. They were Bert and Bert Productions.
Yep. And he, like, the first couple seasons, he was on almost every single episode. Mm-hmm. But that was his baby.
Yeah.
And that's... obviously, I know him from the shows, but that's the movies. But, you know, like, Terms of Endearment... He was turned down Terms of Endearment? That's a bad choice.
Ooh. Wow, yeah.
He was one of the few bright spots of that crappy Dukes of Hazzard movie.
Yeah,
where he played Boss Hogg. Right? Mm-hmm. And also he's in the Adam Sandler Longest Yard, as well as he was in the original, but you know he came back for the reboot.
Mm-hmm. Well, didn't he make some, let's say, professional compromises due to being madly in love with Lonnie Anderson at the time, mm-hmm. that he was sort of chasing her both personally and professionally?
Mm-hmm. Well, they end up getting married.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He seemed like a kind of an ass. At, like, there was a weird moment.
Well, it's just... Are you thinking...
I'm being positive right now.
Well, there's the incident with
was it on Carson or Letterman that he had the
with Mark Summers or whoever?
Yeah, yep, very good.
That's nuts. Yeah, I think it was on Letterman.
Yeah, Mark Summers was talking about Double Dare and like he was just an absolute dick.
It's when he had his hairpiece then too.
Yeah. And so Mark Summers gave it to him, and they ended up having, like, a big pie fight or something like that. But, like...
They were throwing water on each other.
Yeah, yeah. Like, Mark Summers didn't back down from Burt Reynolds, and good on him. But, yeah, just kind of a jerk in his later years, but...
I'm surprised you guys didn't mention his appearance on Beverly Hills 90210.
You don't even give me a chance to comment, and you fucking ruined it.
Well, I know you're going to go for quite some time, so I just got to get a couple more in.
Can't steal the thunder, yeah.
Come on. All right, I won't talk about Cop and a Half, okay?
Rotella's not here. Wow. He only talks about trash movies, so. Feed the cat.
All right, Scott, go ahead. I know you want to talk about the Cosmo Centerfold.
I do. Who wouldn't? No. I know a girl I worked with had it, so she couldn't put it on her desk.
What'd you say, Tim?
Ish.
Highlight of the night. Good night, folks. Here we go. I'm going to feed Andy's cat. Now, there was a stretch. And like you said, Steve, you pretty much bookmarked it. Pretty much from 1972... which was Deliverance, Lewis Medlock, till 1983 when he was Stroker Ace, which was probably the last bomb before the dip. For those 11 years, he probably made about 20 movies, and probably like 15 of them were fucking great. Yes, he was awesome in Cannonball Run, J.J. McClure. He was great in Starting Over. He was great in Hooper. Hooper's actually one of the – that might be an unheralded – Burt Reynolds' performance. Go see Hooper. He played a stuntman. J. Michael Vincent's in it before his body caved in.
Holy shit. Wow.
A bunch of other Robert Klein. I mean, a fucking shit ton of great actors. That is an awesome movie. Highly recommend Hooper. But to me, Burt Reynolds will always be Bo Darville, a.k.a. The Bandit.
Mm-hmm.
1977, black Pontiac Trans Am. End of story. And that he owned like five of those, and he actually donated two to charity. So as much as he was a douche at times, he was very charitable. He donated two of them to to auctions for some charities. But Burt Reynolds, one thing you got to give Burt credit for, because Burt wanted to be a very serious actor. Deliverance was not a funny movie for anybody to watch who's ever seen it. It doesn't make you laugh unless you're a fucking sycophant. But. That's my band of laugh.
Getting punchy now.
He was a two-parter in White Lightning and Gator, but Bandit is his thing. And he, for a guy who probably obviously was, you know, thought of himself as a pretty good-looking guy, and he was, he was best when he made fun of himself in comedies.
Yeah,
and he'll always be the Bandit. Yes, I was not an Evening Shade guy. He was good in The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas. He was good in that, too. But, yeah, once Stroker Ace happened, and then he bombed, and then he didn't show up in Smokey and the Bandit Part 3, and then they made that terrible Cannonball Run 2, everything went right down the stinker, and that includes Cop and a Half.
Cannonball Run 2 wasn't the worst.
It's funny you mentioned Striptease, because that movie sucked, too. But
it did. But, you know, between him and Ving Rhames, that their performances are pretty damn good in that movie.
Boogie Nights is one of my favorite movies of all time. not just yeah, about great. Porn, but because he's great in it. It's just a good cast. Bert's an icon. End of story. I mean, he's that Mount Rushmore of great actors, and that's because he was great at everything. He was good in action films. He was arguably one of the funniest guys ever. And I agree with Andy 100%. If you ever, like, if you on Netflix get – and actually the good thing is the bloopers are on the credits. So you don't even have to, like, get the DVD. Just watch Cannonball Run and watch the credits, because the credits is where all the bloopers are. And you literally shit your pants. That's how fucking hilarious they are. And they were good. And they were great together. Bert and Don DeLuise. They were in Smokey and the Bandit Part 2. He's just an icon. And he crossed generations. I mean, I make fun of Andy, but the fact is he was that role, that 4 minutes that he was on that episode of 90210 in season three. He kind of crossed generations, and now a younger audience was seeing this icon who didn't have to watch the show that their grandmother watched. And then, of course, he gained a whole new audience when he was Jack Horner. So Burt Reynolds is going to be sorely missed, because that was a guy that crossed so many genres, made a ton of money, and knew how to make you laugh. And it's the same thing with Neil Simon. He just wanted to make you laugh in his movies, and that's what Bert wanted to do. But if there's two movies I highly recommend that you may not have ever seen, see Hooper. It is unbelievably funny. He plays a stuntman. Unbelievably funny. And like Andy said, Cannonball Run is just not – obviously the Smokey and the Bandits, but those are popular. Hooper and Cannonball Run are like two of my arguably his funniest movies ever. And – he's going to be missed. He really, I mean, not that he did much the last few years, but he's an icon of Hollywood during that stretch when Hollywood was very, didn't seem as real as it is now. You know, Hollywood was so far away, even if you lived in California, so far away. And Bert was one of those guys, you know, so.
I would recommend his Celebrity Jeopardy appearances also.
AKA the great Turd Ferguson. That's true.
That's funny name, Turd Ferguson. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. I don't like it. I hate my job.
Chinese whore doesn't rhyme with dog.
Plus the great appearances by Sean Connery.
Buck Fuller.
That's a great answer. That's what I yelled at your mother last night.
Suck at your back, suck it hard, suck it long. Well, awesome. On that note, this is going to bring our In Memoriam 2018 show to a close. I want to thank you, gentlemen, for sticking through this little marathon we have here. When I finish editing the show later, we'll see. But let's go around the horn and see what you guys got coming up on both of our lovely feeds here, the Place of Be Nation Wrestling feed and the Place of Be Nation Pop feed. Let's start with you, Tim. What do you got coming up in your world?
Yes, coming up on this feed, the Place of Be Nation Pop feed, we will have another installment of the Marvel Age podcast recorded. We'll be hitting later this month. And I'm sure that Jennifer Smith and I will have another Talk and Pop coming your way before the month is out as well on Place to Be Nation Wrestling. So the wrestling feed, episode 20 of Survey Says drops. Yeah, not too long ago. Yeah, we had a quick episode just covering one event. It was the Clash of the Champions. Number 9, New York Knockout. So, very cool show. Flair Funk. Main event, I Quit match. Check it out. We enjoyed it, and I think you will like that episode if you're a fan of that clash.
Yeah, I do. I actually do remember that. I listened to the show. I'm like, I actually remember this one. And if you ask Scott, I have like the shittiest memory when it comes to stuff. I mean, look at my appearance on the trivia contest.
Oh, God.
I was like,
sounds like.
did do worse than Josh Richard.
Yeah, well, there always has to be like a Santino Morello that gets thrown out after 2 seconds, okay?
Exactly.
We all have our roles to play. Great. All right, Tim. Steve, what do you got coming up? Or what's up? What went up?
I'm everywhere. I'm on
Omnipresent.
Pretty much every episode at this point, I'd say. I occasionally make appearances in the Glenn Butler podcast, Hour Spectacular. When my buddies and I feel like it, we'll do a Mission Indie Possible or a live watch. But what I'm kind of most pushing right now is my son wanted to do a little podcast with me. My oldest at first did, but then kind of backed off at the last second. But has made a list of his best of for main event, Scott. So be prepared for that. Yeah, we just kind of my kids started watching wrestling this year, and we just stick to NXT because it's easier to digest and giving out characters. And so my 7-year-old made a little best of list of his favorites and least favorites, and we just kind of chit chatted for 10 minutes. And I've gotten a lot of really good feedback from it, probably more so than anything else I've done. So that tells how great I am. 7-year-old's more loved. So yeah, check it out. It's a real easy listen, 11 minutes, got a lot of great feedback from it. And, it was a really fun to record.
You're only as good as your guests, which is what I've learned, which is why I have you gentlemen on the show tonight.
Oh, very good.
Awesome. Scott, what do you got coming up?
Well, as Mr. Willie mentioned, we'll be doing main event this week, and, we will be, quietly recapping 2018, but definitely looking ahead to 2019. With AEW and all that fun stuff, and a nice best of list, Steve. Looking forward to that. So Steve, myself, and the brother Nate Milton, we'll be doing that later this week. Also on the wrestling feed next week, JR and I will have our next episode of the Place Be podcast, the January 7th, 1989 Saturday night's main event. Myself, JR, and Peter Winson, a.k.a. Greetings from Allentown. And then you and I, Mr. Atherton, 2 weeks from tonight, we'll be doing the next episode of Year in Pop, 1973. What a tremendous year in the world.
Yes, that is. Yes, and as well as my girlfriend Ellen was born that year, and I had to mention that if I knew what's good for me.
Exactly, or else you'll be living with a cat. It'll be, so yes, you, me, the doctor, and Mr. D'Amato will be doing that 2 weeks from tonight, the next episode of Year in Pop, 1973. So I'm all over the place. A lot of good stuff coming up on both the wrestling and pop feeds. Please listen. These three gentlemen and myself, along as a myriad of other great people, do a lot. And so please listen. A lot of great shows all across the spectrum. 2019 is going to be a great year. And once again, please go to the message board, bigelow34.proboards.com. We're talking all sorts of stuff, wrestling and other stuff. I think we need to expand more than just wrestling right now. But yeah, check it out. It's pretty awesome.
Yeah, it is. I've started going over there and having some fun participating in some of these discussions. Also for me coming up, Great Debate number 2 is up there. It was last week with Jordan Duncan, JT Rosero, and who else was on?
I'm trying to remember. Guy.
Oh, we had the cowboy, Roger Morrison. How could I forget? Yeah, it was a lot of fun. Got a lot of great feedback. Those guys were tremendous. And so you can look for that on the PlayStation Pop feed. Episode 3 should be coming your way in just a few weeks, actually. I'm still working on landing my guests, so I will probably be able to reveal who they are on the next episode of Here in Pop. Also also coming up with the Oscars right around the corner, the nominations should be coming out about a week from today. It's now the 15th, so the 22nd. So it'll be myself and Tim's Talk and Pop partner, Jennifer Smith, along with a couple of to-be-determined guests. We will be doing a preview of this year's Oscar ceremony on who we think should and who we think will win. And then after that, probably another Looking Forward, Looking Back sometime in the February, early March, and more Year in Pop as we go on and so forth. So, I just want to say thank you again to Steve Willey, Scott Criscolo, and Tim Capel for joining us tonight on this look back and saying positive, good words about these people that entertained us or left a lasting impression on us. And thank you for joining us and listening to our show tonight. So for Scott Criscolo, Tim Capel, and Steve Willey. I am Andy Afton. Thank you for joining us, and we'll catch you on the next show.
He's hot on your trail. He ain't gonna rest till you're in jail. So you got to dodge him, you got to duck him. You gotta keep that diesel trucking. Just put that hammer down and give it hell. He's bound to die. Put it up and truck it. Are we gonna do what they say can't be done? We've got a long way to go and a short time to get there. I'm eastbound up. Watch on bandit run.